This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Timothy Eby. Today is 28 August 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Eby is joining us from his home in Hyco, Texas. Good morning, Mr. Eby.
Good morning.
I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to discuss your experiences in the Vietnam War with me. First off, let's start with some biographical background. Can you tell me when you were born and where?
June 9th, 1944 in Dayton, Ohio.
What were your parents' names?
Lowell and Dorothy Eby.
What did your parents do for a living?
He was a farmer and she was a school teacher.
You say he was a farmer. What kind of crops was he primarily engaged in?
When I was young, when I was at home, we had dairy and hogs and the grains that supported that operation. And then he sold the dairy when he didn't have enough sons to keep it going, and went into hogs completely.
You say when he didn't have enough sons to keep it going, how many siblings did you have?
I have two brothers and a sister, younger sister.
All right. How would you describe your childhood there out in Dayton?
The most accurate description would be a poor farmer's son, but we grew our own food and ate well and didn't know any better, and it was a good, wholesome childhood.
Was your father a veteran?
No, as a matter of fact, my whole family is pacifist, always has been, and still are the ones that are left, and I'm the only black sheep in the family.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Where does this pacifism come from, do you know?
We grew up, my great-grandparents and grandparents and parents and all my siblings grew up in the Church of the Brethren, which is one of the main pacifist churches, along with the Quakers and the Mennonites. And so they bought that whole story, and I didn't, basically, in a word.
Now, what do you think led to this? You say you didn't buy into it. Was there any particular issue or turning point, or could you explain that to me?
Well, I don't know how to explain it, actually. It didn't make sense to me, even as a kid, and I was fairly, well, not traumatized, it's too dramatic, but I was troubled by the fact that I had to face the draft and would have to make a decision about this by the time I was 16, and the pacifist approach just did not add up, didn't make sense to me, but I didn't know anybody that had served in the military, at least anybody close, so I wasn't getting that side of the story. All I was getting was the pacifist side, and it didn't make sense. So when I actually, in order to keep my options open, because at age 16, when I had to register for the draft, I was still confused and troubled, and so the only thing that made sense to me that any of my relatives said to me was an aunt who said, "Well, you should register as a conscientious objector, because you can always change your draft status to 1A, and if you register 1A and decide to be a conscientious objector, you will not be able to change it the other way." So that was the one thing that made sense. So that's what I did, and then kind of a humorous sidelight to that is that once I got to Ohio State in college, and I joined up ROTC, office to see what this military stuff was all about. You know, I still hadn't had any exposure to anybody in the military. And this was in my sophomore year, because I went my freshman year to a church school and got more of the same and went slowly crazy. And so then when I decided to commit to the advanced program and get a commission when I graduated, it suddenly dawned on me that I was registered as a conscientious objector.
Whoops.
So I remember there was a major there that was my advisor, and I went to him and said, "Sir, it just occurred to me that I'm registered as a conscientious objector. Does that matter?" His jaw dropped, and he looked stricken and said, "We've got to go talk to the colonel." So I explained it all to him, the professor of air science. And I remember he said, "Well, I have just one question. Have you ever demonstrated in a peace demonstration?" This was in 1966. Actually, it would have been 65 when I was about to become a junior. And I said, "No, sir, I have not, because I don't believe in that." And he said, "Cadet, we can take care of it."
That easy, huh?
And he did. I was 1A in no time flat.
Well, tell me a little bit more about your growing up there on the farm in Ohio. What sort of things did you and your family do? A lot of hard work, I can assume, from the dairy and the hogs and that.
Yeah, it was a lot of work, little or no income, and of course I wanted to play sports, and I wasn't allowed to play summer ball because of making hay and everything, and so I actually kind of grew up resenting all that, and was determined to never be a farmer, and sure enough I have not been. And even though we live, kind of have a little ranch now, I'm not a rancher actually. But it was a Spartan growing up, hard work. Didn't get to play ball in the summertime. The only sports I got to participate in were school related, the school teams. And I played baseball and football in high school and junior high. But it was a good, wholesome way to grow up, you know. One thing, the biggest probably benefit from it was learning how to work. I've never had a problem working hard and working till it was done, and working till the sun goes down, you know, until you're done. And I've noticed over the years a lot of people who grew up in the city or whatever and didn't have to work like that never did really learn those skills, and have had more problems working hard and doing what's required in order to get a job accomplished, or even in military to get a mission accomplished. You know, if it's too inconvenient or too hard, they tend to back off of it before it's done.
Where did you go to high school?
Brookville, Ohio.
What sort of things subjects did you like to study there?
History primarily, and the sciences to a certain extent, but not too much. I had a bad experience in junior high with a very poor math teacher who convinced me that I should never, ever pursue math. And it was confirmed to me that he was a very bad teacher. He tended to destroy kids, you know. He destroyed their confidence. He truly did destroy my little brother, because my mom taught there in the school district, and she confirmed that to me later. But anyway, as a result of his convincing me in algebra, junior high algebra, that I should never pursue math, then I was not able to take engineering in college, for instance, which is really what I was interested in. Aeronautical engineering is what I wanted to study, but I knew I couldn't do math, so I didn't. And I like to say that junior high teacher probably saved my life, because as I got into the Air Force and went through the flying training and everything, I pretty well excelled in the flying. And if I had been an aeronautical engineer like I wanted to and then excelled in flying, I would certainly have applied for Air Force test pilot school and probably been accepted, and then I'd have ended up killing myself. So my junior high math teacher probably saved my life.
Certainly sounds like he may have made some choices a little bit easier for you, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, growing up in the 1950s and 1960s there in Ohio, how aware were you of international affairs, the United States' place in the world, the Cold War as it was evolving?
Well, I would say I was fairly aware, only because this church and pacifist movement that I grew up in was a socially active outfit, and of course I was aware of world events as the United States being the villain in all of them. Of course, the evil democracy of the United States. And so,
now, was this something that was coming from the church?
Yeah, but primarily. Uh-huh. It's the same liberal thing that's going on now, you know, blame America the fear of being envied. And of course, that's deeper than we need to go. But anyway, whatever their motivations are, the liberals blame America first, and that's what I grew up with from the time I could understand speech.
Now, you mentioned that you were never involved in any sort of peace protests or anything, but what sort of activities was your community involved in, this religious community?
Oh, they resisted everything that had to do with democracy in the United States. I have an uncle who's still very much an activist, up getting close to 80, and he would only pay a certain percentage of his income taxes, because he was convinced that whatever percentage he was convinced of went to support the military, and he wouldn't do that. So he withheld that portion of his income tax bill, and then he made the IRS come and get it, the rest of it, from his bank account.
Wow.
And at one point, he, I think at least 1 year, if not more than that, he hauled a load of wheat into the IRS office in Dayton to pay his taxes with, because he thought that a load of wheat could not be used for military purposes.
I can only assume they did not accept that load of wheat.
I think that's probably correct. I was already gone, but I had a colorful bunch there that I grew up with. I'm not real sure how I escaped that, except that I'm kind of one time my mom said, well, we raised you, you know, to think for yourselves, but good grief.
When did you graduate high school?
1962.
Okay, now, what had you planned on doing once you graduated high school in 62?
Well, it was expected that I'd go to college, and I didn't have any argument with that. And so all the Eby children went to, were expected to go to Manchester College in northern Indiana. That was a school sponsored by the Church of the Brethren. And so, sure enough, I went there, and I put in my obligatory freshman year, and it was just awful. It was really bad.
Explain that to me. What do you?
Well, it was all this stuff I've been explaining intensified on you know, the school trying to mold young minds into the mold that they believed in, and I just became more and more resistant. And it's a little town up there in the hinterlands of northern Indiana, and nothing to do, and so I got in trouble, you know. Just I wasn't a very good little Church of the Brethren kid.
What sort of things in particular? Can you give me examples of, you say they were trying to mold young minds, what sort of things were they doing in particular?
Oh, just teaching the one-sided liberal view of everything, you know. Just more of the same. This Church of the Brethren, I'm really going to rag on them since I've got the opportunity here. But they're basically, they call themselves a church, you know, and they are, but they're basically a social action organization, and kind of cloaked in religion. And so they would teach and have activities and all that stuff to further their liberal agenda.
You mentioned that you'd gotten in trouble. What sort of things were you doing to get into trouble? Or do you care to speak about those?
Well, I'm afraid that the statute of limitations may not be out on some of them.
Well, then we can let that one lie.
Yeah, we ended up in a big criminal operation and got a cow up in the third floor of the administration building one night. all kinds of this stuff like that, you know, college kids blowing off steam.
Sure. Well, you say you spent your 1 year there, the obligatory year there. Did you go to Ohio State after this?
Yeah, I snuck over to Columbus without my family knowing. And
really?
On one weekend and liked what I saw, and I just applied on the spot to do my sophomore year and from the rest of the time there at Ohio State.
Now, were your parents paying for your education at this point?
No.
They weren't?
No.
Okay. So that would make the transition a little bit easier. What was it about Ohio State that you liked?
Well, there were things to do there. And it's funny because I went from a little closed-in colony over there with nothing to do and got in all kinds of trouble, and I went over to Columbus, Ohio, to a state school with everything available for a kid to get into trouble with that he'd ever want, you know, and I didn't have a minute's problem over there. I just fit in a whole lot better. Plus, they had ROTC. In fact, it was compulsory because it's a state land-grant school. And so I thought, well, I can at least talk to these guys and see if the blood really is dripping from their fangs, you know. And I went to the Air Force ROTC kind of informational briefing for incoming students, and I thought, man, these guys make more sense than anybody I've talked to up to now, so I just signed right up.
Is that right? Now, why the Air Force?
Well, because I had taken flying lessons while I was in high school and got my private pilot's license. I just always have been drawn to airplanes, and so I wanted to fly. And I could have joined the Navy, but I didn't even know the Navy had airplanes, you know, so... I went with the Air Force because they were the ones that had airplanes.
Well, what was ROTC like for you there at Ohio State?
It wasn't difficult. I kind of fit in to it. I felt more at home there than I'd ever had with any of the pacifist and conscientious objector junk and all that. And I don't know if it still works the same way. I guess it probably does. At that time, there were no scholarships for ROTC or anything. So at the end, if I had started as a freshman there, I would have taken the first 2 years as as an enlisted cadet, you know, without having made a commitment to go advanced and to get a commission. But I was starting out there in my second year of school, so I actually doubled. I took the first year of ROTC, basic they call it, and then I decided I wanted to go advanced and get a commission at the end. So I talked to them about that, and what it did was it doubled up the ROTC academics of the second and third year, and meanwhile I made the commitment and went advanced ROTC and was drilling as a cadet officer, but I was also taking the second year basic academics along with the third year advanced academics, so it all came out, and I actually did 4 years of ROTC and three, and it worked out very well.
It speaks a lot to your dedication and your work ethic, I would say, for sure.
Well, and then, actually, the truth of it is that after I got married between my sophomore and junior years, so not only was I doubled up on ROTC, but I got married, and of course I had to work because I was paying my own way through school, and by the time I graduated, I had a full-time night job, two part-time jobs, a wife and a baby, and a commission, and a degree.
My goodness.
So that was kind of a busy time, and the fact of it is that what I really learned out of ROTC was how to delegate responsibility, and all this stuff that most of my contemporaries were doing themselves down at the ROTC building, I just simply didn't have time to do it because of all this other stuff like having babies and stuff. So I learned to pump up these guys that are junior to me, you know, and get them all fired up about getting this work done on time and properly and right and everything. And they'd do all the work, and I'd turn it in and get all the credit and glory for it. So I went straight to got promoted in the officer ranks. Cadet officer ranks, right straight up, and got to the top rank of cadet colonel, and that was a huge ROTC program. I think the way it was organized was a core, an overall core, and then two divisions, I believe it was, and I ended up as a division cadet commander, and I got a regular commission out of ROTC because I graduated a distinguished graduate, and I got some kind of award, Reserve Officer Association Award or something, and so I was quite an ROTC hero, you know, but it was mostly because I delegated, my skills were in delegating the work and playing the game, so...
Certainly sounds like ROTC worked out very, very well for you.
Yeah,
what was your family's reaction to your one dropping out of was Manchester, I believe you said,
yeah,
college, and moving to Ohio, and two, joining the ROTC? What was their reaction to this?
Well, they basically they thought I was selling my soul in order to fly airplanes. That's kind of what it all boiled down to. I just announced the Ohio State thing to them as a done deal, so they, you know, it was too late for them to object to that, at least with any effect, and they just kind of grimaced and watched as I went through the ROTC thing, and then of course going on to active duty and going to Vietnam and raping, pillaging, and plundering, you know, and all that stuff. That did not go well, but there wasn't anything they could do about it.
Now, well, you're still a student here at Ohio State, I assume, that you're going home for holidays or weekends, things like that. What kind of reception did you receive?
Oh, it wasn't. That wasn't so cold and chilly at that point. Of course, I was also very soon after that married, so I didn't go home as much. And when we did go home, we'd quite often go to my wife's parents. But speaking of chilly receptions, when I came home from Vietnam was the one that kind of seared my soul, and I still feel that one. That was bad.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you would say that. This is a question that I'm going to keep coming back to from time to time throughout the course of this interview. Given your family background and religious background and their beliefs and their activism, so don't be surprised when this question comes up again and again.
Okay.
Now, when did you graduate from Ohio State?
December of 66.
December of 66. Now, you have a commission in the Air Force, and you want to fly. You are obviously a very capable, intelligent, and aware individual. What were your impressions on or about U.S. policy in Southeast Asia, in particular Vietnam at this time?
Well, I don't know how to describe that, actually. I was a supporter of the war, and still am, you know. I don't think it was a mistake that we didn't do it right, but I think we resisted communist aggression rather successfully, even though we ended up losing the war. Kelly, let me change phones here so I can hear better. This one's kind of weak, so I'll pick up another one here.
Sure.
You hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I'll turn this other one off. Okay. So where are we now as far as my attitude towards the war? I graduated from college?
Yes, yes. What were your impressions back in 1966? Because let's face it, you have an ROTC commission. Chances are very, very good you're going to wind up over there. And
oh, yeah.
Probably I had to know that at the time.
Yeah, so, that was the assumption. I didn't have any. My big decision was not whether to go to war or not. It was whether to put on the uniform in the first place.
Explain that to me.
And so when I decided to put on the uniform and serve in the military, then I didn't have any more soul searching as far as the Vietnam War itself or any of that sort of thing.
But you were a new graduate, a reasonably new husband and father. Did this weigh into your decisions at all?
Only later. When I a year later, February of 68, when I graduated from pilot training, I was at the top of the class, and so I got my choice. At that time, at least, you got your choice of whatever the list of available assignments were based on your class standing. And by that time, I had a second baby coming. My wife was pregnant, and we had the oldest girl that was born in college was a year and a half old, I guess, not quite that old. So she was a baby, and so I had my choice of anything I wanted to fly, including the F-105, which at that time was going north and thudding into Thud Ridge, you know, with regularity. And that's what I wanted to fly. That was the F-15 of the day. You know, it was the top assignment that any young fire-breathing fighter pilot could want. And to make it even worse, my favorite instructor, who we got to be very close friends, and I just really respected him. He got a 105 assignment from going from ATC to his combat tour, and the timing was going to work out to where we could have gone through the training pipeline together and gone overseas together, and I really wanted to do that. That's what I wanted. However, I'd go home at night, and I could feel the baby kicking, and I was starting to feel some responsibility as a dad and a husband and everything, and so I had real misgivings about taking on such a very dangerous assignment, because the thud loss rates then were just astronomical. But then I went through pilot training at Moody, and I'd go back to the base the next day, I'd be going supersonic, setting my hair on fire again, and my friend's name was John Brucker, and he was just overjoyed that we were going to do this thing together. It never occurred to him that I might turn it down. So I had a real, real difficult decision then to make about whether my priorities should be at home or whether I should take the one chance I was going to have to fly the 105 and to get into the fighter community, because I knew that there was almost no chance, if I took a multi-engine out of pilot training, that I'd ever get into fighters again. In the end, after a lot of soul searching, I ended up taking a 141 out of pilot training and disappointing my favorite, highly respected instructor and everything. That was where the big decision was, not in going into pilot training in the first place, but coming out of pilot training and choosing an assignment. And I wanted a combat assignment, but I didn't take it because, and I'm convinced now that it was because the second baby was unborn and there were so many things pending. We just didn't know. We didn't know if it'd be a healthy baby, and I didn't want to be halfway around the world dodging flak over Hanoi when the baby would be born and all those things. But I almost could not turn it down because it was a once-in-a-lifetime decision, or a chance. But I ended up taking a multi-engine, and John Brucker, my instructor friend, lasted 3 months before he was shot down.
Oh, wow.
And then, of course, everybody got their turn in the barrel. All Air Force pilots had to have a combat tour before any of them were reassigned to a second one. That was the policy. It was called Palace Cobra Program. So after almost 2 years of flying the C-141 transport, then it came time for my combat tour, and so I chose the OV-10, the forward air controller job, and volunteered for it because my time was about there anyway, and you had a better chance of getting what you wanted if you volunteered. And I ended up flying for a whole year, or 700 hours of flying time, right over where John Brucker got killed. So, you just don't know how it's going to work out.
Sure. Well, before we get you over to your combat tour in Vietnam, Let's get through train first. Where did you go for basic?
Basic?
Yes.
Well, the basic was ROTC.
I'm sorry. Where did you go after ROTC? Well, what training did you receive after that?
Oh, I went to UPT, undergraduate pilot training in Moody Air Force Base.
Okay.
As a second lieutenant.
What sort of things were you doing there?
Just flight training and all the stuff that's associated with that, academics and parasailing and, you know, all those things to prepare a guy to fly jets.
Mm-hmm. What about advanced training?
Both of them were there. The
okay.
Air Force pilot training at that time consisted of, well, a little introductory thing for a few weeks in a T-41, which is a light airplane, a Cessna 172. And then, but basically, the basic training was in the T-37, a little jet, subsonic. And then advanced training was the second half of the year, was in the T-38, and it was at the same base.
Where do you go from Moody then?
Went to Charleston Air Force Base, South Carolina, to fly the C-141.
Okay. Now, you talked a little bit about this before, this multi-engine transport. What sort of things are going through your mind when you make this decision? You were obviously a fighter pilot, of a mind of a fighter pilot first, but why specifically the C-141?
The fighter business is just a whole different world from the transport business, and of course, you know, there's a lot of yin yang back and forth between fighter pilots and multimotor pilots, and all fighter pilots think that all multi-engine pilots just sit there and drone over the ocean for hours on end, which of course they do, but there's a lot more to it than that also, as I found out as I got into it. And that was actually a very interesting assignment. And one of the things for a pilot looking towards his future, one of the big aspects of choosing fighters or multi-engine is that you don't get very much flying time in the fighters, maybe 20 or 30 hours a month, and in the multis you get a lot of flying time. And in those days, in the late 60s in C-141, you got so much flying time you just about gag on it. Pushed, if not exceeded surreptitiously, the maximum flying hours every month for every pilot. It was amazing. Almost never home, and then only home for 3 days, two or three days at a time. But it was interesting. Got all over the world. I saw concrete runways in every part of the world. Not much else, but saw lots of airports. And
where all did you fly?
Oh, just everywhere, all over the world. Most of it was channel traffic to Southeast Asia, of course, but Military Airlift Command, which is what it was called at that time, owned all the transports, and they had responsibilities for Europe and any place the U.S. had a military establishment, you know, stuff got hauled in there by transport, either C-130s or C-141s, and also embassy support. And then, just strange things like support for NASA in the early Apollo shots when they didn't have telemetry stations, yet built all over the world. There were some empty holes on the globe for communications with the Apollos, and so I remember flying a trip to Johannesburg, South Africa, hauling the people and the spare parts and everything for the telemetry birds that stayed airborne all the time and communicated with Frank Borman as he circled the moon and came back, if you remember that.
Oh, yeah.
And so you just got in on all kinds of interesting things like that. Plus, any crisis that happens anywhere in the world, when you see the picture on the front page of the paper, usually there's a C-141 or a C-130 in the background just sitting there, you know. So you got to go to everything that was going on, and then you read about it in the paper and the magazines later, you know. That was kind of interesting.
So you had a number of trips to Southeast Asia this time?
Oh, yeah. Every generally, I'd say 75% of the trips were channel trips to Southeast Asia, and then the other quarter would be different places, other parts of the world.
Where were you flying out of and into on your trips to Southeast Asia?
Flew out of Charleston, and we normally would stop and load whatever it was we were going to haul somewhere in the States, or perhaps once in a while we'd get the load right there in Charleston, but then they had a stage organized, what they called a stage, and the staging points were Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage, Yokota Air Force or Air Base in Tokyo, and Okinawa, Kadena Air Base in Okinawa, and so the East Coast MAC bases, which was Charleston, Dover, Delaware, and the one in New Jersey, just outside of New York. I can't say the name of it right now. Anyway, those were the East, and we had one squadron down at Warner Robins in Georgia. The East Coast bases all staged through Elmendorf and Yokota, and by the stage, you mean that you'd fly the airplane there with the load. You'd park at Elmendorf, and the crew would get off while they were fueling it and doing whatever maintenance needed to be done. The outbound crew was right there to meet you, and as soon as you got out of the seat and got your stuff, they got in, and an hour later were airborne with that airplane and that load. As your crew went into crew rest, then the airplane kept on going, and they'd repeat that at Yokota. And then the third, and this is a normal trip. There were all kinds of exceptions, but a normal channel trip would go from Yokota then down into the zone, as we call it, either any of the bases in South Vietnam or perhaps Bangkok, and also sometimes the bases in, Utapau, for instance, in Thailand, Ubon, Utapau, Udorn, and then on the same day you go down into the zone, offload, and then onload whatever you're going to haul out, and go back to Okinawa, to Kadena, and stage there, lay over, and next crew takes it on, and then when you came out of crew rest, you would take the next airplane on, and the stage coming back to the States would go from Kadena to Elmendorf, and you crew rest and stage, and then the next leg would be to the offload station in the States, and then to your home base at Charleston.
What was all this traveling doing to your family?
It was a stress on the family, but it was just the way it was. Everybody we knew was doing that, and so it was not like you were being singled out. But basically, my wife raised our oldest two children through their infancy up until I got out of the service after 5 years.
How long were you flying the C-141?
I flew it for almost 2 years out of pilot training, and then I had a combat tour, and then I came back to the C-141 to finish out my commitment, and I flew that for flew the 141 out of Travis that time, one of the West Coast bases, until I got out of service.
So you flew the C-141 until about what, 1969, early 1970, something like that?
Yeah, it was sometime in 69. Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, when you were done with the 141, you you say this combat tour was a necessity for you. Where do you go for your fighter pilot training?
Well, it was a 9-month, as the way it turned out, it took 9 months to go through the pipeline. The first step was sea survival for, I don't know, a week or so down in Biscayne Bay, Florida, out of Homestead Air Force Base. Then I went to the regular survival school, which was up at Fairchild Air Force Base in Washington. And that was about I don't remember exactly how long that was. And then I went to a fighter lead-in, they now call it, school at Cannon Air Force Base in Clovis, New Mexico, and got fighter qualified there, and then from there down to Eglin number 9, Hurlburt Air Force Base, which was the headquarters for the special ops wing of the Air Force, and the FACT business was classified under special ops, I guess. And so we got our OV-10 and FACT training down at Hurlburt, and then went to Vietnam from there.
All right. When do you make it to Vietnam? Do you remember the date?
May 15, 1970.
Okay, and you're going to do a one-year combat tour there.
Uh-huh.
Where do you fly into?
Arrived?
Yeah, when you arrived in Vietnam, what airbase were you flying into?
Yeah, well, then on the way over there, we went to jungle survival school, too, at Clark.
In the Philippines?
Yes.
Okay.
And then from there, went to Camarón Bay, where the overall FAC group headquarters was. I think it was the 504th, something or other. And we got a in-country orientation sort of thing there, and then we received our assignment to the squadron that we were being sent to out of that orientation. Up until that point, we didn't know where we'd actually end up in Vietnam.
But you knew because of your training you were headed into the Forward Air Command.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. What was this orientation like when you were there in Camarón Bay?
Oh, you know, it was one of these bureaucratic things that they have to check off the boxes that you've been oriented. It's just an introduction to your year of combat, and also then, you know, that's where you got your assignment, but squadron assignment. But it was like a week or so, maybe 5 days or week of just, I guess, classes and classroom instruction and stuff like that.
Was there anything to orient you on the history of culture, language, the Vietnamese people, or the way the war was being fought, or anything like that?
No, not really.
Okay. So you received your squadron. What squadron you'll be with there at Camarón Bay? Where were you going?
It ended up that I was sent to the 20th TAS, Tactical Air Support Squadron, headquartered at Da Nang Air Base up in I Corps up north. And I, as a result of that assignment, I knew that I would be flying out country in Laos rather than... you see, there were two wars for FACS. One was, well, there were several actually, but basically you were either an in-country FAC assigned to a squadron but attached to an Army unit, and you did the close air support and the reconnaissance and that sort of thing for the troops on the ground, or the other war for basically for FACS was the out-country interdiction war over the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos. And then when I got assigned to the 20th TAS, I knew that I'd be flying in Laos.
Is that what the 20th did exclusively?
By this time, by 1970, that's true. Prior, well, that's not totally true. They did have 20th TAS, and I didn't even know it at the time, I don't think, but the 20th TAS did have some FACS that were assigned in country and attached to the Army. Yeah, but the biggest role of the 20th TAS was out country.
Well, here you are. You find yourself in Vietnam. You're part of the 20th TAS as a forward air controller. You know you're going to be flying over Laos. As a farm boy from Ohio, raised in a pacifist family, what's going through your mind here? This has got to seem very, very foreign to you.
Yeah. I remember getting off the airplane. I guess it would have been from Cameron up to Da Nang, and standing in the shade waiting for transportation to the squadron in my 1505s, the khakis, standing in the shade, not moving, and sweat running off my fingertips and dropping onto the ground. And I'm thinking, I don't believe I can handle a year of this. It was very foreign.
Well, Da Nang must have been incredibly busy at that time. Can you describe for me what you saw there in Da Nang?
Yeah, of course, I had seen all these bases as a MAC pilot, you know, going through, but never stayed overnight or never crew rested in country. So it wasn't like it was just totally, you know, off of Mars or something. But knowing that I was going to be there for a year was a sobering, very sobering thought. From a pilot's perspective, Da Nang and Tonsonut and Cameron Bay, but especially Da Nang and Tonsonut, were just nightmares for air traffic. Just a nightmare. They had a big mix of airplanes from 01 Cessnas to C-141, huge transports to tactical fighters like you know, the F-4 and stuff. And it was pretty much just keep your eyes on a head on a swivel and don't let anybody hit you, especially in a 141. You weren't maneuverable, so you just tried to not let anybody else hit you because you couldn't get away from them too well. But yeah, it was incredibly busy. If you were on the ground there, it was dirty and noisy and busy. And of course, Da Nang was, they called it Rocket City. They took a lot of incoming rockets. And yeah, it was not very like Brookville, Ohio at all.
I can imagine not. Now, were you based out of Da Nang or one of the numerous forward bases?
Well, I didn't know what was going to happen to me until I got there. And then I went through four or five days of training there to get me, well, I don't know, what they called it, but I flew three or four times and shot rockets at a rock island out in the water, and kind of got familiar, did some strafing and things, you know, and got a little bit familiar with stuff there in Da Nang, and only then did I get assigned then onto a forward operating location of the squadron at Pleiku up in the Central Highlands down in Tukor.
Now, what plane are you flying? The OV-10 or the O-2?
The OV-10.
OV-10, which was a more modern plane.
Yeah, it was fairly new then still, and if you wanted to be a fact, that's the one you wanted to fly.
What was your camp like? What were the conditions there at Pleiku?
Well, Pleiku was an air base with permanent buildings and BOQs and everything. It wasn't like you were living in a tent or anything. And it was pretty nice. It was nice from a weather point of view. It was at 2,500 feet elevation up in the mountains, and so it was, most of the time it was cooler, and we had single rooms, one man to a room up there. It was a small base, but it wasn't like a camp or something. It was an established base. Disadvantage was it was very close to Cambodia, and we took a lot of incoming rockets and mortars and RPGs and B-40 grenades, and four times a week, I imagine, average. We would get hit either sappers through the wire or rockets or mortars. So it was kind of hard to sleep there, but it was when you could sleep, it was nicer than Da Nang. I hated to go down to Da Nang after getting used to Pleiku. Pleiku wasn't as dirty. We actually had grass here and there. Da Nang didn't have any grass. It was all dust blowing and everything. So it was a little bit more like living in the country. But another disadvantage was that once the Vietnamization program got started under Nixon, one of the first things they gave to the Vietnamese was the perimeter defense, and that was disconcerting. That's when the sappers kept coming through the wire every night. So, but other than the fact you could die in your bed, it was a lot better living up there.
Okay. It's obviously nothing to laugh at, but the way you put it was a little kind of humorous. Well, can you take me through one of these experiences, whether it was a mortar attack, rocket attack, or sappers? Can you take me through one of these experiences that you had there?
Oh, it happened so often that you wouldn't even get excited about it. As long as it sounded like the perimeter guards were responding well, you know, you could hear the 50 cals firing and everything, I didn't even get out of bed after a while, you know. And I only got out of bed one time and rolled underneath it for a mortar attack, and that's when I heard the mortars coming out of the tubes, you know, being fired. And I never had heard that before. I'd never been around mortars or anything, but I was in a deep, deep sleep in the wee hours of the morning, and I heard this hollow-sounding, kind of a staccato, kind of tong, 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 you know, and even in a deep sleep, somehow I knew that was mortars coming out of the tubes, and they were so close that you could hear them, and so I rolled under the bed that time. And that's the only time I ever rolled under the bed. Now, the most memorable attack through the wire was, I had no idea what the date was, but I was it was pretty far along, and I didn't normally even get out of bed, you know. And, what would keep me from getting out of bed was when I'd hear the gunships, helicopters cranking up over at Camp Holloway, which is right next door to Pleiku. It was an army camp and a helicopter base, and you would hear the gunfire start up out on the wire, and what they would do generally is come inside the base. There was a kind of a big pasture. I guess that's a country boy description of an open space, but a grassy pasture area out there next to our hooches, and ran over to where the perimeter was, and they would come in there in the pasture and set up their mortars and fire on the flight line, and then walk back out wherever they got the wire to come in. They'd walk back out, and so, but then sometimes they'd be shooting small arms and stuff too. And as long as when I'd hear the firing start up, I'd listen for the starter whine of the Huey gunships over at Camp Holloway. And as soon as I'd hear them start up, I'd know everything was going to be all right, and I'd go back to sleep. But so one memorable night, all that happened, and I heard the starters whine, and I went back to sleep. And then a little while later, I heard it starting up again. Big pitched battle right outside where we lived there, somewhere in the pasture and along the wire. And so I was listening for the starter whine, and I didn't hear it. And that woke me up, and I thought, So I sat up in bed and looked out the window, and it was 00 fog. I mean, you couldn't even see the blast wall 3 feet away from the window. And I thought, oh man, we're in for it. For one thing, the gunships couldn't fly, and another thing, you wouldn't be able to tell that anybody was there until they were 2 feet from you, you know. So I got up out of bed and put on my boots and my helmet and my flak vest and got my M16 and all the ammo I had, and walked down to the corner of the blast fence facing where all the firing was coming from, and set up my little resistance point, you know. And then I'm thinking, in this soupy fog, all I'm going to see is a little bit of motion, and I'm not going to know whether it's a good guy or a bad guy. It might be a guard that got lost, and he's groping around out there. What am I going to do? Am I going to fire, or am I going to take a chance and give him an opportunity to throw a satchel charge over the wall, or what am I going to do? And I thought, oh Lord, don't make me decide. And sure enough, I never did see anything, and after a while, the firing died down. Then I realized I was in my skivvies, bare-legged, and with a black vest and a helmet and red and white striped skivvies. By that time, the other guys were kind of sticking their heads out their doors and everything, and I took a little bit of razzing for the rest of the year about that.
I can imagine so. Now, you mentioned a moment ago that when the Arvin were taking over camp guard, the perimeter guard duties, this was a little unnerving for you. Can you explain why?
Well, they were, when the sun would go down, they would too. You know, they'd be up in their guard towers, but then they'd sleep during the night. And so we were essentially wide open. That's the reason they normally would not catch the NVA coming through the wire. And I had a very low regard for our Arvin allies. And I, you know, I only saw one little bit of corner of the big picture, but what I saw was not
very encouraging for the reliability and the desire to fight on the part of the Arvins. And I thought, well, if they're not willing to fight for their own country, what am I doing here, you know?
Can you cite me a specific example of this?
Well, whenever there would be a crisis of some sort where the Arvin would get scared, they'd run. Or, for instance, I helped out on a Huey getting shot down that was loaded with Arvin troops, and the other Huey that was with them there on the operation, and this was in South Vietnam, somewhere north of Pleiku, and I was just driving back from my mission in Laos, and I saw all this going on, and so I kind of capped them, and I think maybe I strafed for them a little bit or something. But anyway, you couldn't keep them off the helicopter that was rescuing them, and it was overloaded. You know, they were just panic stricken, and so they had to kick them off and stuff to be able to fly at all. And of course, all they had to do was come back and get them. But they were so panic stricken and wanted out of there so bad that they doomed the mission from their panic. And that was just one example off the top of my head that I remember. They were just unreliable and not very warrior like from, you know, my little bitty corner there. I understand that the South Vietnamese Marines and some other units were much better and more fierce, especially in 72, you know, when that line of resistance up there, when the NVA came across the DMZ, there were a lot of examples of heroism then, but I hadn't seen any of that. And they were just irresponsible, because the other first thing, along with the perimeter defense that Pleiku gave to them, was the water supply. And immediately the water started having periods of being turned off, you know, or didn't work or whatever, and the pressures go down. And then we had guys that got hepatitis and other diseases from contaminated water, and it was just simply because the Vietnamese running the thing were irresponsible and couldn't keep it running or didn't try hard enough to keep it running. And so, you know, just a steady diet of that. And plus, we had to constantly watch the Vietnamese that were hired to work on the base for sabotaging things and bringing. There was a maid up in Da Nang that worked in our 20th task hooch there and cleaned and everything, and she was a trusted maid because she'd worked for him for several years. And a fellow walked into the latrine, and there she was packing the toilet bowl full of C4 plastic explosive, and she was going to hook it up to the flusher so that the next guy that flushed was going to blow up the building.
Wow.
And, you know, it doesn't take too many things like that before you don't have too many warm fuzzies for your erstwhile allies.
Sure. Did this give you any reason to doubt the American mission there? As you mentioned, you were there and your comrades were there, the United States was there, but you didn't see this will to fight, and you saw this kind of behavior apparently on a regular basis. Did this give you any reason to doubt the American mission there working with the South Vietnamese?
Yeah, actually it did. The longer it went, the more I began to realize this is just a futile thing, and what we needed to do was take care of each other for 12 months, try to get everybody possible back home, and that was pretty much the extent of my commitment after a few months there in Da Nang and Pleiku.
Do you think that was a pretty common occurrence?
Yeah, I think so.
What do you think that did to the overall effort and morale of the American troops there?
Well, the morale was, there's two answers to that. When I first got to Pleiku, we had an ALO, air liaison officer. Since we were a forward operating location of the bigger squadron in Da Nang, we couldn't have a squadron commander, even though we had a large operation that really could have been a squadron of its own there in Pleiku. But we were a detachment, so we had a commander of the detachment, he was called an ALO, who was our immediate boss, and everybody loved him. He was just the kind of combat commander you want to have. You know, he led from the front and was fearless, as he expected us to be, and his priorities were killing trucks and keeping his boys alive. Those were his two priorities.
What was his name?
Warner McGraw.
Warner McGraw.
Warner R. McGraw. I wrote a story about him, in fact, with that title, his name. So morale in our unit then under him was sky high. We were a good outfit and had good morale. Not that we were especially devoted to the you know, geopolitical scene, but we were devoted to each other and devoted to Colonel McGraw, and so our morale was high. And then he got replaced by just the opposite, and boy, you want to study in contrast, you should have been there watching that unit go to pieces. It was awful. And so our morale was lower than low after that, but it was all due to our lack of leadership. And then on a bigger perspective, I've read a lot about, I've been fascinated by firsthand accounts of people who've been in combat in any war in any job, you know. It used to fascinate me as a kid, which is probably part of the pacifist warrior thing, you know, that I grew up with. But it even fascinated me more after I had had my combat tour to read these guys and all their experiences and their reactions to them and everything. And what happens when a guy goes into combat in any war, you might start out with all kinds of patriotic fervor, you know, and flags flying and martial music playing and everything. But if you survive that first part, and the killing just keeps going day after day after day, it ends up that patriotic commitment and everything kind of fades into the background, and you end up fighting for the guy next to you. That's the reason you keep fighting within the broader context. But on a personal level and on a unit level, after a while, because killing is a dirty business, you know. It's not pleasant, but you keep on doing it. For one thing, you have to, because that's your job, that's where you are. But mostly you do it for the guy next to you. I would do it for the guy flying the next mission after me. You know, if I could kill that gun, then he wouldn't kill my buddy. And that was my experience. And until I did all this reading later, I thought that I was it was a result of being disillusioned, you know, and realizing that this was not going well like it was supposed to and everything. But then later on, I realized that's a natural thing from anybody in combat, that you get through one day at a time, one firefight at a time. You try to save your buddies and survive it and go home when your job's done, you know. And that's exactly what happened to me.
Yeah, it's certainly a very common sentiment expressed by people who were in combat over the years, you know, from the Civil War diaries and then things like that we've seen emerge over that time.
Yeah.
Well, what sort of things did you do there in Pleiku for recreation, for diversion?
Handball is what saved me. There was a concrete handball court there, and we, those of us who did play handball at least, would just wear ourselves out in that court and get rid of the toxic waste in our bloodstream, you know, that way. We would just play all out until we couldn't walk anymore, and then we'd lay on the concrete and breathe a while, and then we'd go back and play some more. And so that was the biggest thing that helped me survive. And we drank a lot, of course. That's a common theme.
Now, you mentioned toxic waste. What do you mean when you say toxic waste?
Well, you know, it's not bloodstream, but your nervous system, and you got a guy who lives in mortal danger day after day has to blow off steam. And the most constructive way I blew off steam was playing handball, and the other way was to drink a lot.
I would assume that this was pretty common among the men up at Pleiku. Is that true?
Yeah, especially the drinking. Not all of us, not everybody played handball, but I think everybody drank a lot.
Well, Mr. Eby, can you take me on your first mission as a FAC with the 20th Staff?
Well, of course, that was a dual ride with an instructor to become familiar with the AO, the area of operation. And out of Pleiku, we covered the southernmost sector of the trail of Laos, and they call it the tri-border areas, where Laos and Cambodia and South Vietnam all come together. And so we had you know, a certain geographical sector there that we were responsible for. And so my first mission was, well, actually, my very first mission was in the back seat with an experienced FAC. That's what that was. And that was just to watch another guy work and just to see the geography and see the trail and see the IDPs, the interdiction points, and see where the guns were clustered and things like that. Just kind of get a feel for it. And then I flew dual with instructor in the back seat, and I don't remember really too much about that mission. I remember feeling uneasy because, you know, I don't know how much you know about FACs in particular, but we flew little slow propeller-driven airplanes down low, and out in Laos the guns were big. And you couldn't get away from them, you know. You couldn't get high enough to get over them. Couldn't go fast enough to get anywhere. So the only means we had to survive was our maneuverability. And so you just had to stay moving all the time, turns and climbs and descents. And you just had to do it as a matter of instinct, just to, because the gunners, if you got predictable, even in a turn, they're very, very good at shooting down airplanes in turns. if it's a predictable turn. So, and that's why so many fighters got shot down, because the faster you go, the more predictable your flight path is. And, you know, they could roll into a turn all right, but the gunners would meet them around on the other side, even if they were going fast, because they could predict the radius of the turn. So the way the facts survived was to act like a mosquito, just stay unpredictable for, you know, no more than, just change something no more than 5 seconds at a time. And so that was all kind of made me feel pretty uneasy, because I wasn't used to that. And
it'd be difficult, I would think, to be aware constantly of having to change your pattern and your habits.
Well, when your life's on the line, it tends to remind you of it.
Sure, sure.
I didn't get lazy till later on. A few times I kind of slipped up, you know, when I was more at home with the threat and everything, and I'd get busy doing something, and then somebody would pop a round past the canopy or something like that, and I'd think, well, you dummy, you know, you quit jinking there while you were busy. So, but I didn't have that trouble at first. And I became an IP then, that I became the one to ride in the back seat with all the other new guys coming in after a while. And I didn't notice any of them getting lazy either. They were all very conscientious about their jinking.
What kind of enemy fire were you facing? What kind of guns did they have out there, by and large?
Well, they went from 57 millimeter down to 37 millimeter and 23 millimeter. Those are all anti-aircraft artillery with explosive warheads. And then there was a lot of 50 cal out there, just blanketed everywhere. That if you went low, you got hosed by 50 cal, because they were just everywhere. And they had some what they called ZPU, which was that was a terrifying thing. It was a little bit bigger than 50 cal, and they were four barrel, and they fired so rapidly that you could actually see it coming. Looked like a snake coming up through the air, you know, even without tracers. And but not too many of those. Some. And then if you got low enough to get out of their regime, then there was always small arms down there, you know. So there wasn't any safe place to be. It's just you had to pick out a crease and keep jinking and hope for the best.
What were you flying with on your OB-10? What sort of weaponry did you have?
We had there at Pleiku, and at that time, we had, for the out-country mission, we had four pods of rockets, and then we had four internal M60 machine guns, which were, in that environment, they're kind of like pop guns, you know. They weren't good for anything except for strafing very close in, and the only reason you would take that risk is if you had a team of special forces on the ground getting hammered, which happened a lot. So they were very handy, those pop guns were, for that purpose, but you wouldn't use them for interdiction for any reason, because if you were close enough to use your pop guns, you were way in over your head on against all the defenses. And then we carried a centerline fuel tank, which gave us 5.5 hours or so of endurance.
Can you take me on your first solo interdiction mission?
Oh, huh. Well, I can tell you a little story about my first dual ride first.
Please do. Please
and,
do.
Of course, I was in the front seat and the instructor in the back. And in the back seat of the OV-10, the instruments are just basic instruments. You can't navigate back there. You don't have any instruments to navigate. You can't, Well, you didn't have a pickle button. You didn't have an armament panel or any. You couldn't do anything but ride along, and you could fly the airplane with the stick and the rudders, but you couldn't. You couldn't shoot. You couldn't navigate and everything. So, well, the preface to this story is that when we went through training at Hurlburt, all these instructors said, "Oh, you transport guys gonna love this because, you know, in transport business, most of what you have to deal with is bad weather and terrain and all this kind of stuff, shooting at low approaches and everything." And they said, "You transport drivers gonna love being a FAC because it's all daylight." Visual, VFR, you know, what good is the fact if he's in a cloud or at night and he can't see anything, you know? So I thought, well, that's pretty cool. That'll be fun. And on my first dual ride, I'm up front with all the instruments, and the only experienced FAC in the airplane is in the back with nothing. And we come back to Pleiku. It was at, towards the end of the southwest monsoon. And we're going to land back there at home plate, and there was a monsoon embedded thunderstorm right over the field. And when that would happen at Pleiku, it rained real hard. The radar would go down, and the only way you had to shoot an instrument approach and get in was a very precision, non-precision approach called an ADF approach, and the ADF needle will swing and point to lightning and then, you know, all that kind of stuff rather than pointing at the station. And the ADF transmitter on Pleiku is the only thing that would stay transmitting during a heavy rain. So, and since it doesn't have a glide slope or any of that kind of precision stuff, and so you got to do a procedure, turn all these instrument procedures, you know, to get lined up on the runway, and then you descend to an altitude and drive in level, and you hope you see it by the time you get there, all this kind of stuff. So here I am on my first time flying this strange little airplane on my own, trying to land in an embedded thunderstorm with the water running in the cracks of the canopy and running over the radios and stuff, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, that instructor back at Hurlburt, who's sleeping soundly in his bed about now, needs to be here now, the one that told me that I was going to love this daylight VFR stuff. Well, we got in. You still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Yeah, okay, I heard a click. I thought maybe it went away. But my old multi-engine instrument experience put me in good stead there, shooting that ADF approach to an embedded thunderstorm.
Take me on your first solo then.
First solo, okay. During my dual rides, the weather, the monsoon was just starting to break up, and the weather had been too bad to get up in the northern part of our sector. So I hadn't even seen any of that countryside yet. And some of that was some of the more hot areas for guns. So I had to do discovery learning on my own solo as soon as the weather started to break up. And I don't remember any one outstanding thing about that first solo mission except that I saw some territory and parts of the trail that I had never seen before, and so I was doing on the job training there, just getting checked out on what was where in the area that I hadn't ever seen. But that's about as dramatic as I can get on my first solo ride.
Okay. Well, can you take me on the first time that you were actually involved in combating in the interdiction process?
First time
you encountered the enemy.
I don't remember what I was doing or where it was, actually. See, in the daytime, they fire tracer rounds so that they can track their own rounds, you know, and adjust to your flight track from where the last tracer went, you know. And in the, but in the daytime, you can't see the tracers unless they're very, very close. At nighttime, you can see them. You can see the muzzle flash and tracers coming right out of the gun pit. Of course, you can't see any details on the ground then to be able to pin them down. But I was trying to think of the first time I saw a tracer. But usually the way we knew they were shooting at us was to look up above and see the airburst going off, you know, the flak burst, like in the movies of World War II and the B-17s, you know, those black flak bursts. Generally, that's how we would learn that they were shooting at us. Of course, it was way too late.
Yes, indeed.
But if they were very close, they would kind of pop. I guess that was the supersonic. That would be the shock wave. And then you look up and you could see the tracers going by of the tracer rounds. But you didn't want to be that close if you could help it. And I don't remember the first time I saw that. It just kind of started happening, I guess. And generally, they would shoot when you were putting in an airstrike on trucks or an airstrike of any sort. It's when they would be the most active. If they thought they could catch you in an unguarded moment, they would fire at the FAC on his own. And they were tracking. I felt sure they were tracking me every minute of every mission. But they just weren't firing unless I could, you know, displayed that I was becoming predictable somehow. And there were times when they really surprised me, and then I realized that I had screwed it up. And it's really a wonder I didn't get shot down on those times. But it was a lot of facking was the big sky concept. Little airplane, big sky, chances are they're going to miss.
I guess that would give you some comfort.
Well, very little.
Yeah, I don't know how much. Well, why don't we go ahead and take a break there for now, Mr. Eby. This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Timothy Eby. Today is 3 September 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Eby is once again joining us from his home in Hyco, Texas. Good morning, Mr. Eby.
Good morning.
When we last spoke, you were telling me about some of your more memorable missions with the 20th TAS interdiction missions on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Could you pick it up at that point for any other interesting missions or particularly memorable or dangerous missions?
Well, yeah, as part of my checkout, when I first got to play coup, I rode in the back seat of a young lieutenant named Jim Butler just to kind of get the layout of the land and get used to this brand new environment. And we were ginning around just doing our normal fact thing. And then all of a sudden, one of the SOG Special Forces long-range reconnaissance patrol teams that were sneaking around out in Laos just about all the time, one team or another, they got in trouble and called up on the radio, you know, and when that happens, things get really, really busy. And here I was on my first time over Laos, and I was just riding in this young lieutenant's back seat. And he got so busy, he forgot about me, and he was on four radios at once and looking for the team, flying low level. And I think we probably, when we found him, we strafed for him and everything. But I was just back there with my mouth hanging open and my eyes big as saucers. And watching all this, thinking, you know, I was totally lost. I was so far out of my element that I was thinking that there's no way I can learn to do this. This is humanly impossible. And, you know, what have I gotten myself into and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, boy, I gained a new respect for that young lieutenant. There's two aspects of the story. One of them is that before long, flying solo, and the same thing happened, which happened not infrequently. And, of course, there I was then doing all those same things. And only later did I look back and realize that the first time I saw that, I was so overwhelmed that I couldn't believe it. And there now, then, here I am. As a matter of course, almost, not really, not quite, but because it's still very busy, and you have to do about 8 things all at once, and any one of them will kill you, but when there isn't any choice, well, you just, that's what you do. And so that was one aspect of the story. The other aspect of the story is not very long after that, Jim Butler was killed. And so that also was an eye-opener to me that this is kind of serious business. And I was appointed his summary courts officer, which meant that I had to take care of all of his personal affairs and pack his stuff up and send it to his widow and everything. And so that was right along the first few weeks that I was starting this new business of being a FAC, and it was kind of a rude awakening on several levels.
Sure. Now, what did it mean to you to have to pack up his things and send them to his widow? I assume you had to write a letter as well to her?
Yeah.
What did that mean for you?
Well, it was it's really bad duty. It's something that's hard to take, especially after I had gained such instant respect for this young man, and wasn't very long before he was dead. So what I did, I wrote a personal letter first to his wife and expressed some of my feelings and thoughts on a personal level, and then I told her then that from this point on, then it would be official Air Force stuff and taking care of business, you know, but I wanted her to know how I felt about Jim.
How long had you known him?
Well, just a couple of weeks, but he was the first one I flew with when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like welcome to the war, you know.
Now, by this time, you also had a wife and 2 kids at home.
Right.
Did that make it especially difficult for you?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it did. Yeah. It's just, I don't know. you get used to anything, I guess, with time.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think I probably imagined who would be my summary course officer and how they'd feel about communicating with my wife, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of my early important missions and things that happened.
What did you find the most difficult thing to overcome as you were trying to become a seasoned FAC like Jim Butler?
Well, I guess it was just such a huge change when you go from a big old heavy transport where MAC, the command, has iron fisted control over everything you do, you know, and you're under scrutiny most of the time or all of the time, and you have to answer for anything that happens and stuff. And then you go to this little bitty airplane where you can dart and dive around, and you don't pay any. When you're out in Laos, you see there isn't anybody out there to check on you.
Yes.
Everybody's got better sense than that. And so you have as a fact in Laos, you have a tremendous amount of freedom to do whatever you think's the right thing to do or the best thing to do to get the job done, whether it has anything to do with the rules or legality or not. We were just covered up with these rules of engagement, you know, big book, thick book of rules of engagement. As soon as we got the off the ground, the gear in the well, that thing went out the window, because there wasn't anybody out there in Laos to check on you anyway. So you had great latitude to do the job the way you wanted to do it, and for a young guy, you know, that's a lot of responsibility and authority. And so I guess getting used to the freedom of operation and getting used to flying a little airplane where you shoot things instead of a big airplane where you just haul things around. That was a pretty big transition to make.
What about being fired upon, being shot at?
Well, wasn't much fun.
I bet not.
you had to learn how to deal with that too. During the daytime, you couldn't see the muzzle flash of a gun unless you were just happened to be staring right at it. And already looking directly at it, you could see it sometimes then. But as a general rule, with the sun shining bright, you wouldn't see the muzzle blast, and you would not see the tracers coming. And so you had to get used to the idea of somebody's probably shooting at you, you know, and you don't know where it is, which way it's going, and where it came from. And the only way you could know for sure was after it was too late and you look up above you and the airbursts were going off above you, then you knew, yeah, they're shooting. And then the interesting thing was that I guess you do things with your mind that make you more comfortable, and so you just kind of don't, when you're flying in the daytime, you don't worry too much about it unless you see the airburst overhead. Although it is kind of an uncomfortable feeling, you know, not to be able to see it. And then one night, I could look it up here. I'm not sure what month it was, but all of our O2s got damaged or destroyed in the revetments in a mortar attack. And the O2s flew the night mission normally, and the OV-10s flew in the day. And so, and by that time I was an instructor pilot. I was made instructor in July. So sometime after July is when this happened. And so the boss pointed at me being the instructor pilot and said, you got the magic night qualification finger, and now you got to take all your OV-10 pilots out at night and get them night qualified. So I started flying at nights exclusively in the back seat, checking all these guys out at night, because it's way different at night out over the trail where there are no lights, no references, and can't see anything. And it's spooky at first, but then I found out real quick that you can, at night, you can see the muzzle flash, and you can watch the tracers come right up out of the gun pit, you know, and you can tell if they're going to come close or not. And all of a sudden, that darkness became a great source of comfort, and because if they're coming right at you, all you had to do is move over, you know, make a turn, and they'd miss. And of course, in the daytime, you can't see them coming, so you don't have that luxury. So I flew probably a whole month or so before I got everybody checked out. I flew at night, and then plus the O2 started coming back online, and then flying in the daytime after that, then I was real uncomfortable because I couldn't see the tracers anymore, you know, so it's just what you get used to.
So were you more comfortable overall flying the night missions or the day missions, you think?
Well, I think probably more comfortable in the day missions, actually, because at night I felt real vulnerable to getting run over by the fighters, because they're flying with their lights out, and you're flying with your lights out, and you know, they're diving down through your altitude as they make their bomb runs, and then they're coming back up through your altitude as they pull off, and you could try to coordinate which direction you'd be from the target, and they'd try to roll in so that they wouldn't hit you, you know, but boy, there was a big danger of mid-air collision at night, and so I think probably I preferred to be able to see the fighters and not see the tracers, and then the other way around, all in all. Plus, at night, it's so easy to get disoriented, flying under flares. You know, you drop a flare to illuminate, and boy, that I hated that, because on a dark night with no references, and you pop this flare, and it's up at altitude, you know, maybe 4,000 feet or something, plus it's drifting in the wind, and it's swinging like a pendulum back and forth under his parachute, and it's just automatic that your point of reference becomes that bright point of illumination, you know, and then as you're shooting rockets and the fighters are diving down and everything, that primary point of reference, besides moving itself and rotating, I mean oscillating, you dive from above it to below it and back above it again, you know, and it's so easy to get disoriented. It was pretty tough. I preferred, when I was flying nights, to drop log markers, which were actually, they were logs, pieces of log treated and everything, and they would fall on the ground and burn for about 20 minutes or so, and I'd, if I had a truck or something, you know, a target on the ground, I would try to drop a log marker on one side of it and then on the other side of it, and that would not only give you a stationary point of reference, but it would tend to keep your orientation a lot better, because you had two points and you can line them up and represent a line for you on the ground, you know. So even though there wouldn't be flares above, you could keep your orientation better with the ground black, and that you'd have two points of light on the ground. So.
Sure. How would you go about at night finding these enemy locations? During the daytime, you can fly and see them. Visual confirmation of what's there on the ground. How would you do it at night? Just fly around until someone shot at you?
Well, that's pretty effective, yeah. But primarily, you know, we were out there to be looking for trucks, and at night they used their headlights.
Okay.
They hooded their headlights and had just a little slot of light coming out, but still you could see it, especially with the Starlight scope, one of the early generation night vision devices, which was the reason we didn't use the OV-10 at night normally, because we could not open the canopies on the OV-10, and the instrument lights on the instrument panel, no matter how dim you would take them down, they would reflect on the canopy, and if you moved the starlight scope through that reflection, it blanked it out because it was too much light. So the O2, they sat side by side on that, in that one, and they normally carried a navigator for the night mission, and he would open his window, which you could do in the O2, and just hang the starlight scope outside, and you didn't have any of that reflection problem. So that was the primary reason. They mostly flew at night, and we mostly flew in the day.
I was going to ask you that. I wondered why it was one versus the other. That makes
yeah.
sense.
Plus, it was the night was a little more survivable for the O2 as well. But anyway, especially with the starlight scope, but even with the naked eye, you could see those little bitty headlight lights snaking down the trail. And in the daytime, we pretty well shut off the trail during the daytime, and they just didn't even drive. It was very unusual to see a mover during the daytime. And so what we looked for then was truck parks and places where they would hide the trucks and hide equipment and supplies and everything. But they were very, very adept at camouflage, and so it was hard to find that stuff.
What would generally give away one of these sites when you found one?
Well, you might see a shape under the trees or alongside a stream or something, a shape that just didn't look natural. And you look at it a little closer, and it might be like a stack of supplies under a tarp and camouflaged with brush or something like that. Or you just look for things that were man-made, straight lines and square corners. Or you'd look for a trail that would, tire tracks and so forth that would go into a place and not come out the other side, you look for dust on the trees build up during the dry season. Later on, after about 9 months or so in my tour, maybe a little earlier than that, I was flying one day and looking with binoculars. We had to fly high enough because of the big caliber guns that we had to use binoculars to see details. And of course, that was bad because your field of view was so restricted through binoculars, and you couldn't see anything whizzing by you or anything. If the tracers got close enough, you could see them pop by, and they kind of made a little pop as they went by because of the shockwave, but if you're in binoculars, you couldn't see any of that. And I was looking at a clump of bushes, and boy, the hair just stood up on the back of my neck. every muscle went taut, and I didn't know why. But I kept track of the bush that I was looking at, and I tried to discern what I had seen that made me go all crazy like that. So I circled back around and tried to get in the exact same location again, watching with binoculars, and that time I saw it. The sun, I got just the right angle where the sun illuminated a square corner under that bush, and I knew that a square corner is always man-made, and I knew that was the corner of a gun pit. And I killed the gun, and sure enough, I was right, it was. So I learned from that to find guns, and I kind of developed a sixth sense or something for guns, and I pretty well specialized in guns for the end of my tour, the last 3 months or so. So anyway, from from looking for square corners and straight lines and man-made things, you would see little details that normally you wouldn't pay any attention to, you know. And once I got to killing guns, well, I kind of honed that talent, that skill, to a high level, and started finding camouflaged guns pretty regularly.
Now, when you said that you were killing these guns, were you firing on them yourselves or calling in airstrikes with the fast movers?
No, I'd call in airstrikes. In fact, I would call when I had a pinpoint gun, a pinpoint target like a gun pit, I could get paveways. In those days, they were brand new, high-tech smart bombs, you know. Now they're everywhere, but that was the first generation of laser-guided bombs, and they were pretty stingy with them. They wanted to be, the command post wanted to be assured that you weren't wasting their expensive, high-tech, brand-new smart bomb, you know. And so at first, I'd find a gun and also learned that they came in either batteries of two or batteries of three. And I'm not sure really what made the difference, unless the 37 millimeter were maybe in batteries of two and the 23 millimeter in three or something. I'm not, maybe the other way around. I'm not sure. But anyway, I would find them, and then I'd have to, and I wouldn't say anything on radio because the enemy was listening to all our radio channels. And I would go back at the end of the mission then and land and call the command post on the landline, tell them what I had, and convince them that it was worthy of one of their paveways, was the code for smart bomb. And then I set up a time on target for the following day and go back, and the F4s with the smart bombs would show up. And the trick then, the skill that you had to develop, was communication. To communicate to this guy, you have to, you know, I'm down at 4,000 feet going 120 knots, and he's up at whatever, 15,000 feet going 450 knots. And so I would try to put myself up there and look at what he was looking at from his perspective, and walk his eyes then into that one particular bush out of 1,000 bushes all around it, you know. And that was kind of an acquired skill. You had to practice that a little bit.
Now, how did you become proficient at that? That seems like it would have been very difficult. What sort of things would you do to make this more and more accurate?
Well, by transposing myself up there to his altitude and speed, I learned to start with a big landmark that anybody could see, even a fighter pilot, you know.
Right.
like a bend in a river or a big exposed rock or something like that that stood out to him from that altitude, and then walk his eyes to in the right direction to a smaller landmark, and then to a smaller landmark, and then count the bushes from that one, you know, or something along that line. And I could only got good at doing that when I was able to imagine myself up there looking at the big picture that he was seeing, like looking at a map, when I was down there looking at bushes, you know. And so I got pretty good at it pretty quick, because F4s run out of fuel in no time at all. And so you have to communicate well the first time, and in order to get the job done.
Now, was this something you came up with on your own, this approach to guiding them in, or was it something
yes.
others talked to you about?
No, pretty much on my own. You know, well, then as an instructor, I also learned that there's only so much you can teach a new guy, because he's overwhelmed, start with, and I can relate to that because I just went through it.
Sure.
And so you can't really teach them the fine points very effectively until they've got some of the basic things down. And so for their five dual missions before the check ride, or the time you have with them as an IP, you pretty well concentrate on teaching them to stay alive for 12 months, and that depended on teaching them to jink effectively and unpredictably. And you'd work on that until that became second nature for them, and you'd try to teach them how to look for little signs that would indicate that something was down there, and you almost never know what it is until you investigate a little further. But for the little signs that give you clues, you know, and things like that. And when it came down to, then they had to learn to put in airstrikes. And, of course, communication with the strike flights was a big part of that. But as far as, learning how to walk a guy's eyes into the right bush out of a thousand, you just kind of learn that on your own.
How long were you flying these FAC missions, these interdiction missions, before you were asked to become an instructor pilot?
Well, I just looked that up, and I got combat qualified in the end of June, I think. Yeah, 22 June. And then I went for my IP checkout on the 29th of July, started that, and went up to Da Nang for that because that's where all the bigwigs were.
So what did you think about this switch to becoming an instructor? Were you disappointed?
Well, I was kind of disappointed. I had made captain in the training pipeline before I got there, so I showed up already as a captain, and almost all of the line pilots flying the daily missions were lieutenants. There were a few captains, but arriving there as a captain meant I was leader of men automatically. And another guy named Bill Hartzell and I showed up at the same time. We had also gone through training together, and we both went to play coup. And so Colonel McCraw made each of us, Bill and I, flight commanders. Well, I'd never been a flight commander before. I didn't know what all that was about. You know, remember I explained to you my ROTC training, which amounted to find a good man to do your work for you while I
right.
while I had babies and three jobs and that sort of thing. So anyway, I became a flight commander and had half of the OV-10 guys in my flight, which basically meant I had to write effectiveness reports on them, OERs, and that's about all, really. If we, in a normal fighter squadron where you fly as multi-ship flights, that flight commander has a little more meaning, but as a fact, you're always solo and always just one airplane. So it was more just of an administrative arrangement than anything else.
Sure.
But then Colonel McGraw gave the Prairie, Chief of Prairie Fire mission to Bill Hartzell, and he gave me the IP and the training officer job. And that kind of disappointed me a little bit.
I bet so. Can you talk about that a little bit? Prairie Fire is obviously a very large, important operation.
Yeah, Prairie Fire was Special Forces business, the Army Special Forces SOG troops. In our area, we worked with the guys out of Kontum, which they called CCC. Center. They had a CC North, and that's a Command and Control North, mm-hmm. Command and Control Center, and a Command and Control South.
Right.
The way the SOG guys were organized, and we worked with the ones in Kontum, and they're the ones that went sneaking out into Laos and Cambodia in small teams, gathering intelligence and snatching prisoners and things like that, doing crazy stuff. And the the FACs, who were the Prairie Fire FACs, qualified for that, were the ones that controlled the airstrike portion of that mission. They inserted them into the target area with helicopters, and but the Prairie Fire FAC would control the fighters and kind of coordinate all the air assets that went into these operations,
mm-hmm.
putting them in and then covering them while they're on the ground, and you know, and monitoring them and babysitting them, basically, and then bringing them out, infill and exfill. So that was kind of a specialized, high intensity operation, and with a lot of low level flying and shooting, and so that was pretty exciting stuff. That's even though Butler wasn't Prairie Fire qualified, neither was I. We both ended up helping these guys because we would be on station when they got into trouble, you know, and when that happened, you dropped everything else and went over, got the ball rolling to bring them out, and we'd have to strafe for them to keep the guys that were chasing them away and that sort of thing.
Well, can you go into some detail about any particular mission that you were on as part of this support for the SOG efforts?
One that I wrote a story about. There were two F-100 pilots who, I think their wing got deactivated and they went back to the States. I believe that's the way it was. And these two guys hadn't been in country long enough to be able to go back home to the States. And so they sent them up with a desk job with the Army to play coup in the DASC, the Direct Air Support Center. Headquarters there, flying a desk and working with the Army, and oh boy, for fighter pilots, you know, there's nothing worse.
Yeah, that had to be awful for them.
Yeah, and so they like to hang out with us because at least we were aviators and we were flying combat, you know, and they whined and moaned, and anyway, to make a long story short, I got tired of hearing them whining and moaning because I'd say, well, come fly with me. You know, I've got a seat open in tomorrow morning or something. Oh, they'd hem and haw. And because to a fighter pilot who can go 450 knots, a FAC was a suicide mission, you know. and so they found all kinds of excuses to not fly with me, but yet they kept on whining and moaning. And so I finally just flat got in their face and called them yellow-bellied and, you know, and all that stuff. And a fighter pilot would rather be dead than embarrassed, so they agreed to how they'd go. And so I took the first one on one early morning flight, and it was a quiet day, and no big thing happened or anything. And he reassured the other one that they had this fact stuff all wrong, you know, it was a piece of cake. And so the other one, who actually was a little bit more cocky even than the first one, he jumped in the next morning, and boy, he was already ready to go, you know. Boy, it's good to be back in the air and everything. And no sooner than we got out there than one of these teams started yelling on the radio, and they'd been running all night, and they were lost, and they you know, they were in bad situation. So I got busy, just like I was describing when I was flying with Butler. And because at times like that, you have to be able to listen on three radios listen to people talking to you while you're talking on the fourth one, and you can't miss anything. You know, it's crazy stuff. All while you're flying and map reading and hunting for the team and all this stuff. You know, it's just I couldn't do it anymore. Than a man in the moon now, you know. But
well, who's talking to you? You have four radios going. Who is on each of these radios?
We had two FMs. The team would be on one, and the what we called Covey Alpha, our own shop back at Play Coup, you have dialed up on the other FM.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had a UHF that used for the fighters, and you had a VHF that you used with the airborne command post, which was call sign was Hillsboro.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we had an HF too, but we didn't have to use that.
Okay.
And so you'd have the team yelling at you on one Fox mic, you'd be talking with Covey Alpha getting the Prairie Fire assets launched on the other Fox mic, and calling for fighters through Hillsboro on Victor on VHF, and perhaps talking to another FAC, maybe the Prairie Fire FAC, or maybe another one that's airborne on the UHF, you know, all at the same time, and everybody's got to be doing what they need to do or you're going to lose the team, you know. And so anyway, it was one of those deals, and I flew right over the team and found where they were. And of course the bad guys, you know, they, if they're not listening to the radio, at least they know that the FAC just went overhead and then he pulled up real high and real steep, you know, so he knows now the FAC has found the team. And so the bad guys normally would try to assault the team at that point real quick before the big bombs came, you know. And so the team leader kept on yelling, you know. He said they're overrunning us, they're coming, they're all amongst us. He said strafe. So I pulled up as high as I could, which wasn't very high, in an OV-10, you know, and then peeled off and came in and strafed in the vertical. I usually, in a tight situation like that, I would strafe straight down because it denies the bad guys any place to hide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can get behind a tree or a log or a rock or something if you're down low shooting at low angle, but if you're shooting straight down, there's no place for them to hide. So the OV-10 had propellers, you know, and so pull those big old props to idle, and they acted like speed brakes, and you could just kind of hang in the air and wouldn't dive all that fast and give you more time to strafe. So I was strafing and walking it around, you know, with the rudders and talking on two or three radios, and it occurred to me that I was hearing some really strange sounds, but I didn't have time to think about it, you know, and I kept diving and diving and diving, and the trees coming up closer and closer. Of course, this guy's an F-100 pilot, and his perspective is that if you don't start your 4G pullout by 4,000 feet, you're going to hit the ground, you know. Well, I never even made it up to 4,000 feet to start with, and here I am going straight down. These strange sounds that I was hearing kind of in the back of my mind was this guy making some really funny animal-like sounds in his throat, you know, like, so I pulled out real quick. Of course, I had to anyway. And when things settled down a little bit, he told me that he, just as I snatched the nose up and the put the G's on the airplane and pulled out right on the treetops, that he had reached for the ejection ring at that instant when I snatched it and missed, or else he would have punched out. And got on top of this team that was getting overrun anyway, you know. So, and he was unauthorized. I didn't have any permission to have him with me or anything. So that would have been a real bad deal. But the end of the story is that neither one of those guys ever went flying with me again, and they quit whining and complaining, too.
That desk duty sounds better and better all the time.
Yeah.
Were they able to pull the team out?
Yeah.
My
effort there was just to keep the bad guys off of them for enough time for the helicopters and everything to get out there. And by that time, the prairie fire FAC came. It was out there, too, you know. So he took over the extraction, and they had some dead and wounded. I don't know how many of them survived, but they got everybody out. And I never had the courage to ask whether my strafing had caused any of the casualties or not. Mm-hmm. I never did find out.
What's your opinion? Do you think that it possibly could have?
Well, yeah, because I was. I didn't finish that. The guy on the ground, the team leader, you know, he said, strafe my position. He popped smoke, I think purple smoke or something. He said, strafe me. There's more of them than us, and we're going to die anyway, so just strafe. And so I did. Strafe my own guys because they were all mixed up with the bad guys. And so it could very well have been that I shot some of my own guys, but I confirmed with him. Well, that was about the time I was doing that tail slide at the top of the climb, you know. I said, confirm that you want me to strafe you. And he said, yeah, there's more of them than us. So, but then after we got back, I lost my nerve, and I never did ask whether I shot any of my own guys.
How was that set with you over the years, Mr. Eby? Is that something you think about occasionally or
yeah.
often or not at all?
Yeah, but, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures, and so I take pride in the fact that the team got out, and they wouldn't have if I hadn't been there, mm-hmm. and I just don't dwell on the fact that I might have caused some of the casualties.
Sure.
I did cause some casualties for the bad guys because the team leader was cheering and yelling, you know, yeah, keep it up.
Now, at that moment when he's telling you or confirming with you to strafe his position, does any hesitation come in your mind, or is it just something you know that you have to do because that's the situation?
Well, there was enough hesitation at first that I, and with everything else I was doing, I asked him to confirm that is what he wanted, and otherwise, I wouldn't have, you know, taken time to confirm that before I started shooting.
Now,
but once he confirmed it, well, I knew how desperate it was, and so that's what I did.
When the Prairie Fire FAC took over for the extraction, what were you doing? Were you still in the AO, or were you heading back? Where were you while this was going on?
Well, you know, once the pressure was off me personally, I don't remember what happened after that, but I'm sure I would not have left the scene. That I would have, I'm sure I must have just kind of circled over the operation, you know, capped it, and they had fighters too by that time, and but if they needed my little pop guns again, well, I'd have been there for him, you know. I would not have just wandered off.
Did you ever have any personal contact with any of the SOG teams or alert teams?
Yes.
What were they like?
They're crazy.
Elaborate on that for me, please.
Well, you don't have to elaborate too much. We had a small group of them who flew in our back seats for the Prairie Fire guys. Now, I didn't fly with any of them because I wasn't Prairie Fire qualified, but when they would come down from Khantoum and actually live with us in our hooches and fly in the back seat for the prairie fire missions. And then sometimes our prairie fire guys would go up and land at Khantoum and pick them up too. But we had significant contact with the riders, we call them, Covey riders. Our call sign was Covey. And while I did not have contact with the other SOG troops, I did with the ones that were designated as riders. They were the more experienced ones who, you know, they they flew in the Air Force backseat and spoke Army, you know. And they're crazy guys. They have no regard for their own safety, it seems like. And all of them had been there multiple tours. It seemed like years and years to me. They were all steely-eyed and experienced Special Forces troops. And I had every respect for them. They were amazing. And now later on, in later years, as I've read some things that they've written and met a few more of them and everything, it's amazing to me. Well, even at the time, it was amazing to me that here they were all the writers were NCOs. They were enlisted men and Army and Special Forces and SOG Special Forces, and it doesn't get any more elite than that. And they tend to look down their noses at everybody else, you know, with good reason. They earn the right to do that. But they love their facts. And here we are, all college boys, all commissioned officers, you know, Air Force wimps, but they loved their facts, and they seemed to respect their facts more than anybody else besides the elite guys in their own group, you know. And so that I noticed that at the time even, and then later on, over the years, as I've spoken to some and read what they've written and things, it's true. They respected and admired those Air Force facts more than anybody else. And, of course, the reason was, if it wasn't for the fact, they'd all be dead. Because the fact was always there to pull their bacon out of the fire. And they acknowledged that, you know, very freely, that if it wasn't for you, I'd be dead. I've gotten to know one or two of them pretty well, you know, good friends since then, and they never cease to remind me that that I'm their fact, and they'll introduce me, you know, this is Tim, he was my fact in Vietnam. And that really makes me feel good when they treat me like that.
I bet it does. Do you have any more experiences with the SOG teams you'd like to share?
Well, I spent Christmas morning of 1970 strafing for another team.
Okay, tell me about that time.
Well, that was not quite as dramatic. I didn't have any fighter pilots in the back seat that time. In fact, I think I was in the back seat, and I was checking a new guy out. But it was another one of those deals, you know. They were in trouble, and we strafed for them to take the heat off of them, and it took a good while to get them out. It was later in the day by the time the prairie fire guys finally got them out, and so, you know, I didn't see the end of that extract. I was back on the ground then, but in fact, they got some choppers shot up and things like that on that extract. there were Huey assets at Camp Holloway right there beside Pleiku that were designated, or their job was this SOG prairie fire mission, you know, and pilots that specialized in doing that, Huey pilots, and you talk about the guys with big gonads. Those Huey guys were the ones that I respected more than anybody else. And one of them's name was Brillo because he had an afro hairstyle, you know, and his hair was real, real curly. And so his call sign was Brillo because he looked like a Brillo pad. And
was he African American?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He was the premier Huey pilot in my mind. So he was on this extract of this team on Christmas morning, or it was Christmas afternoon by the time they got him out. And as they lifted the team out, he took a 50 cal in the transmission, which was the Huey's most vulnerable point. And he was losing his torque, losing his power, and he knew he wasn't going to make it back to any place friendly. Like Dock Toe was the nearest place where they'd normally go land and catch their breath and fuel and things. and he knew he couldn't make it back there. And the only place in friendly hands at all in that whole area was the top of a rock needle that stuck up, I believe it was 1,100 feet straight up like a spire called Leghorn, and it was a listening post for these SOG troops. They had a fortified little outpost up there on top of this rock. It was almost impregnable, so they didn't have to worry all that much about being overrun or attacked or anything, because it was straight up on this rock, and they monitored their radios, and they did a radio relay mission for the teams and all that sort of thing up there. And they had a little chopper pad on a leveled off spire of a rock there that was smaller than the skids of a Huey, if you can believe that.
Wow.
And the chopper guys hated landing on the thing because the wind would come sweeping up that rock, and as they would come in for a landing, the wind would hit the front of their rotor diameter, you know, the rotor disc. It would hit that, and it would upset them as they were, you know, getting just ready to touch down, and it was hard to land there on Leghorn because of that. Well, Brillo was losing power, and so he auto-rotated onto that little bitty speck of rock at Leghorn, and he made it. And they said that he bounced kind of once and stuck and didn't fall off the edge. And over the radio came Brillo's raspy voice saying, "Merry effing Christmas." So that's the other part of that that extraction that I remember.
Yeah, that must have been some kind of relief, I would think.
Yeah, I think.
Wow. Now, in August of 1970, I see in the forms that you provided for us, you are on temporary duty.
Right.
With Rustic Facts flying over Cambodia. I believe that's out of Benoit Air Base.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell me about that from start to finish, your experiences there? It seems like you were there for around a month or so.
Yeah.
What led to this temporary duty here to start off with?
The Rustic operation following in June, following the invasion of Cambodia, then the U.S. decided that even though it was illegal for us to put in airstrikes out there of our own fighters in Cambodia, the government decided that they could provide spotter planes, as they call them, you know, in other words, FACs for
right.
Cambodia to support the Cambodian friendly forces. And so they cranked up this squadron. Their call sign was Rustic, and that was the very beginning of it. Was in June, I think, maybe July, and so they needed help to flesh out the squadron temporarily until they could get a permanent party in there to become the Rustic Facts permanently. And so a few of us from Pleiku and a few from Da Nang and I don't know where else, they sent TDY down there just to fly for a month until they could get their manpower up to speed. So I rode down there. There were four of us in an O2, which had to be overloaded, but there were three of us going down there to stay, and then the O2 pilot. That was out of Pleiku, and then I know some went from Da Nang too, from the 20th TAS, and so we Cubbies became Rustics, and there were some interesting aspects to that mission. It wasn't all that dangerous, but it was politically, and this was all super, super secret stuff, you know. And but anyway, we would, it was a long, long drive to get out there to where the friendlies were. And the fact is that the bad guys, the Khmer Rouge and NVA, owned all the countryside. And then the friendly forces were holed up in various places, just holed up, you know. They pretty well just cooped up, and I don't know if they went on patrols. I suppose they did, but at any rate, there was a contingent of them at Kampong Tom, one of the towns near the Mekong, and another one at Chenang. That was their West Point. That was their military academy of Cambodia up north. And Kampong Cham, and those seemed like the big ones. And then I think there were another couple. But anyway, we'd go out there and we'd check with the ground commander and see where the bad guys were that had been shooting stuff at him all night, you know, and everything like that. So we put in airstrikes in support of the good guys, and we also would try to support the convoys, the resupply convoys that were going out to take stuff to these places. And later on then they also did a group of boats and ships on a river. What do you call that? Same as a convoy of trucks. I forget now what the name of it was, but I never did do any of that, patrolling up and down the Mekong. They were trying to resupply Phnom Penh, too. One of the interesting aspects of it was, by the time I got there, some of the ground commanders still didn't have anybody that could speak English, and they spoke only French and Cambodian. So the Air Force put out a TWIX, you know, a message worldwide, except for some reason they excluded the continental U.S., but any Air Force personnel of any rank and any grade and any job title, you know, AFSC, who's fluent in French call this telephone number. And the guys that were silly enough to do it showed up in Benoit in the same clothes they were wearing when they dialed that number, you know. And, they were showing up daily. And the only thing they had in common was that they were fluent in French. They were airmen, no classes, and NCOs, and we had one first lieutenant showed up who was a French speaker, and I think he was an intel officer or something. And I mean, with no training, no background, no nothing, here they are. And I flew with a couple of them on their first missions. After, you know, they'd come in off a transport and their eyeballs still going around in orbit, and we'd put them to bed and let them get acclimated to the time changes and everything, and then somebody would take them down to the PE shop, the personal equipment, and get them outfitted in the parachute harness and the helmet and the survival vest and all that stuff. Which they had absolutely no training in how to use any of that stuff. And throw them in the backseat of an OV-10, and away we'd go. And I remember one or two of them, you had to show them how to climb up on the footholds, you know, on the edge of the side of the airplane there. And crew chief would strap in their parachute connections and their seat belts and shoulder harnesses and their radio connections and all that stuff that connected to the airplane, you know. And then I called the crew chief down and I climbed up. And this one I'm remembering was a sergeant. He was an NCO, and I said, "Sergeant, you see that ring sticking up there between your legs at the front of the seat? Yellow with black stripes on it?" "Yes, sir." I said, if I say the word bail out, you just reach down and pull up on that thing." I said, "I will never say bail out unless I want you to reach down and pull up on that handle. Is that clear?" "Yes, sir." And I said, "Sergeant, congratulations. You are now combat qualified." Away we went. It kind of worried me, though. I felt like a mother hen, you know, and
sure.
With these guys, because, I mean, if they bailed out there miles from any friendlies, I don't know if anybody showed them how to even use their survival radios, you know, but they wouldn't have had a chance. And so, as a result, I flew more... or less aggressively, I guess, more conservatively with those guys, because I just felt responsible for more than myself, you know. And so that was kind of a bad thing, really, because you do better in combat when you're kind of aggressive, kind of semi-aggressive and not foolhardy. You know, there's a fine line there sometimes.
Do you think this in actuality lessened your effectiveness?
Well, not too much. I didn't see a lot of head-to-head combat out there, and I didn't see it as the key point, because there were some convoys that got hosed and so forth, and I was strafing for and stuff, so probably people were shooting at me, but it was all small arms, you know, and somebody's used to facing down 37 millimeter, that's no challenge. And so I didn't feel too threatened, and I probably, you know, I didn't get in any of those desperate situations with an interpreter in my back seat, so I wasn't really tested. But I suppose if it really came down to the nitty-gritty, that I'd have probably done what I needed to do and hope for the best for them, you know, the guy in the back seat. But the end of that story is that those guys were, every one of them were outstanding. Boy, they acclimated to that fact business in a matter of a few days or a week, you know, and they went from not knowing a bomb from a rocket to being able to put in an airstrike themselves if they needed to, which proved one time. Had an airman no class in the back seat, and it was so far out there that the fighters were always out of fuel when they got there, and so they never had any time to mess around. Well, I had a convoy trying to get to one of these outposts that was under attack, and about two, 3 miles maybe from its destination, and the destination was also under attack, and I had two sets of fighters right at the same time, both of them out of gas, and neither one of them had time to wait for the other one to work before they went to work, you know. So I got halfway in between the two targets, and I told my backseater, you work that one, and I'll work this one. And here, I was hoping that the fighter lead on that one would have been like a wing commander or something, and he's being put in by an airman no class. I thought that would really be cool. But he did a fine job, and he got his in, I got mine in, and the fighters went home.
Now, you did this for a month. Were there any really memorable missions that you were in on as a rustic?
No, I remember, you know, shooting some things and stuff, but I had one engine go bad, and now that's the one time when I was more conservative because of a greenhorn in my back seat. You know, I drove all the way out there and let down to working altitude, and there wasn't anything. Whoever it was that I was going out to, I don't remember if it was a convoy or what, but they weren't under attack at the moment. It wasn't like it was a really pressing thing, but when I pushed the power up to level off at like 1,000 feet or whatever, working altitude, one of the engines just didn't want to work right. You know, it wouldn't come up to power and everything, and since the good guys weren't in immediate danger, I just turned around and went back to Benoit rather than to try to nurse the engine and complete the mission, you know. And if I had been solo, I would have done that. But because of this kid in my back seat, well, I just took him home. Now, the other, one of the interesting things about that month of August, I don't really, you know, the monsoons are different in different parts of that part of the world. There's a southwest monsoon and a northeast monsoon, and Da Nang was under the influence of the northeast. Pleiku was under the influence of the southwest, and so I don't know whether in August there was a changeover or something, but every afternoon, well, not every, but most afternoons, when I'd be going home if I flew the noon mission or something. A squall line, a huge, big, nasty squall line would build up between me and Benoit, you know. And it wasn't all that thick, but it was nasty. And we planned, because we had to drive so far out and drive so far back, we only had 3 hours on station, and that put us just about out of gas by the time we got back. We'd planned 5-hour missions, and quite often we'd run over, you know, some. And so here I'd be facing this squall line with my tanks nearly empty and Benoit right on the other side of the squall line. And so I'd just pick out the lightest part of that woolly burger, you know, and just punch on through it, and it would be real rough and real wet for a few minutes, and then Tui would spit us out the other side, and there'd be Benoit right there in front of us. Just pull off the power and go down land. So that was kind of interesting. I never did investigate that to see why that was so consistently true. Another interesting aspect of the rustic mission was the Rustic Alpha, which was the radio relay site for the Rustic Facts and FM radios was located up on the top of a mountain called Nui Ba Din. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yes.
It's, I think it's northeast of Saigon, out in the flat plains, and there's just this beautiful conical-shaped mountain that just sticks up. And Rustic Alpha was up on top of there, and of course we talked with these guys, you know, as we were out there flying our missions, and they'd relay our requests for air and all of our requests and all of our stuff back to 7th Air Force headquarters. Oh, that's another, brings up another point. But Nui Ba Din, I didn't know a lot about it, but I had heard about the battles that the Army fought for control of the mountain, because they wanted it, you know, they wanted it for this comm site up on top. And it was a bloody, bloody, bloody battle that went on for a long time, because there's tunnels and caves and all kinds of things. And the end result was that they never did run the VC or the NVA completely off of Nui Ba Din, but they did secure the top and they secured the base, and the enemy held the center, held the slopes. And it was that way, as far as I know, until the end of the war, or at least until they gave up their comm site on top. And I often imagine myself when I was talking to these guys flying along there, you know, what it was like there on top of Nui Ba Din, and which stands for Black Virgin Mountain, I believe. I mean, that's Vietnamese for Black Virgin Mountain. Because I couldn't imagine living up there in a little enclave with knowing that there's enemy trying to kill you all underneath you, you know. And sure enough, that's the way it was. And since then, I've read enough and talked with enough guys on the FACNET and so forth that were radio operators up there, and it was worse than I even expected, because the bad guys would assault them regularly. And sometimes they would get through the wire. And they had some pitched battles, and where these radio operators had to turn into infantry soldiers, you know, in order to save themselves. So that was kind of an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
A little point of history there. Most people have never heard of any of that stuff, but those radio operators are affected to this day by their tours up there.
I can imagine.
And the other interesting aspect of this Rustic mission was that it was all very, very sensitive politically, and top secret and everything. And so at first we couldn't put in any of our own air, any U.S. fighters. Then my roommate, Wilson, oh good grief, can't say his first name, Mike Wilson, when there at Benoit, we shared a room, he announced on the radio to a ground commander, a Cambodian ground commander, that you know, the guy wanted air and he wanted bombs on you bum this, you bum that, you know. And so Mike said, he let his guard down there for a minute, and he said, okay, I'll call for air, and if we can't get any of yours, in other words Cambodian fighters, we'll get some of ours. Well, there was a Newsweek reporter listening to that.
Uh-oh.
And Rustic 08, who was my roommate, became world famous for letting the word out that we were using U.S. fighters in Cambodia. Big time breach. And I don't know that he got in any trouble.
That's impressive.
Bad scene. But anyway, after that, then we started being able to request U.S. air but the request had to be approved by the four-star commander of 7th Air Force in Saigon. Personally, each strike had to be approved by a four-star general.
Wow.
Well, quite often a four-star general will be in a meeting or at lunch or in a briefing or not to be interrupted, you know. And so there's a war going on out there in Cambodia, and the general's at lunch, so you can't put in any airstrikes. So that was kind of just a typical goofy, stupid thing. And even if he was at his desk by the phone, it would take 3 hours from the time he made the request to get fighters on station. And, of course, we only had 3 hours of station time, so the normal way it worked was that you'd make a request for air, and then you'd have to go back, leave for home before the air would get there, and you'd have to brief your replacement FAC, Rustic, on the radio about what was coming and what the target was and what the situation was, you know. So the targets were all fleeting because they were all troops, you know. So by the time the 7th Air Force commander would get around to approving the airstrike, well, the targets would be gone anyway, and it was all pretty frustrating.
It's another good example of the political issues influencing the way the war was fought, for sure.
Absolutely. The interesting thing was that we, you know, the ground commander would say, we take mortars from such and such village, you bum village, bum village. And, of course, we had to pay a little more attention to the rules of engagement out there because they were watching us, you know.
Right.
Like the commander of 7th Air Force was watching every move we made. And so we had to confirm and confirm and confirm. Where are the friendlies? Are the friendlies in the village? The ground commander didn't care. He said, you bum village. It was his village, you know, but we were the ones that were concerned about the friendlies. And so it was all pretty frustrating.
Did you ever get the impression that the those who were asking for the airstrikes may have been asking for the airstrikes for other than military purposes? There may have been political or other issues behind this.
No, you know, they were out there on the ground getting shot at. We were in the air getting shot at. We're the ones that are prosecuting the war, and we didn't have time, and they didn't have time for any of that big picture political stuff. They're just trying to save their skin, you know. So I didn't have any reservation about that. Now, they were kind of bomb happy. They were usually low on supplies, and, you know, they'd have light caliber weapons and stuff out there besieged in the boonies, and so they liked big bombs a lot. So I did get the impression that they might have been kind of cavalier about throwing bombs around because it made them feel better, or, you know, it take the pressure off of them. And if you're getting shot at, that's some pressure, you know.
Sure, sure.
But the fact was that they weren't nearly as concerned about collateral damage, as we called it, as we were. And it was their own people in their own country and their own villages, you know. So it was a bit of a conundrum there, I guess.
Sure.
But I didn't have any reservation about their motives being sinister at all.
Now, when you had come in from a particular mission, come in from a particular flight, and this was when you're based out of Pleiku or the short time that you were serving with the Rustic FACs, what would you do? What would typically be your routine, if you had a routine, when you were back at camp?
Well, of course, we'd debrief the mission with intel. We had an intel shop. There's an interesting little aspect. The Rustic mission was such a high in not impression. What's the word I'm struggling for here? Anyway, they watched what we did as individual rustic fact missions from the Situation Room in the White House, along with 7th Air Force, Four Stars, and everybody in between. And so one time I came back from a rustic mission, and rather than to debrief the wing intel shop, or maybe that's what I did, instead of talking to a rustic intel, I went to the wing intel shop. A guy dialed the phone, and I debriefed the White House on the intelligence out there that was going on in the field in Cambodia. That just happened one time to me, but I know it happened to others too.
Now, who were you speaking to in this debriefing?
I don't know. Somebody in the Situation Room, I imagine.
And this was something that they regularly did then?
It wasn't regular, but profile—that's the word I was trying to think of. That was a high-profile operation out there, trying to keep a secret from the American people, primarily.
What about in terms of relaxation? Obviously, being under this kind of stress, you'd think that there would be some effort to relax and to shake some of this off of you. What sort of things would you do to relax?
Benoit, I don't remember much. I do remember going with a jeep full of guys to a Chinese restaurant over in Long Bend, which was close by, and we went to a restaurant that had tablecloths and good Chinese food, and I thought, man, I've forgotten about all this. You know, this is great. And as far as I know, that's the only, sure enough, restaurant with tablecloths that I ate in the whole time I was in country. But in Pleiku, I think I mentioned the last time that I played a lot of racquetball, and they had a hobby shop and with tape recorders, and so I spent some time copying music tapes and things like that, which I've never listened to since.
What kind of songs were you listening to?
Oh, you know, the standard old 60s and 70s stuff. You know, I don't remember specifically, but things like Mamas and Papas and all those Creedence Clearwater Revival and just all those groups that were popular then.
Did you ever get a chance to go on R&R anywhere outside the country?
Yeah, the first thing that happened, my wife got on a wives' charter to Bangkok. She made a reservation, and she was going to be in Bangkok 2 weeks, and then of course the charter going back, and of course. Now, we were supposed to get a week of leave and then a week of R&R during the year. And that was still while Colonel McGraw was there, the good guy, Alo. And so my wife had set up the dates and everything of her charter flight. And so I applied for a week's leave. And I told Colonel McGraw that what the deal was, and the reason I wanted to leave for that particular time, and I would take it in Bangkok. And he said, "And she's going to be there 2 weeks?" And I said, "Yes, sir." "And you've only asked for a week of leave?" "Well, sir, that's all I get." "Well, that's right, that's right." He said, "Well, I'll tell you what, this is why we love the guy so much." He said, "If you'll give me your week of leave, I'll give you a week of AWOL, and we could fly to Thailand tactical, and the authorities didn't have any control of us, where if we took an R&R scheduled flight, well, they had control of when you came and when you went, went and came." And so he said, "We'll get you over to Ubon tactical, and I'll give you a week of AWOL, and you give me your week of leave, and you'll be there till your wife leaves.
Wow.
So I got 2 weeks off, and we had a wonderful time in Bangkok.
That sounds very decent of Colonel Crook.
He's a great guy.
You were fond of him.
Guy.
So what sort of things did you and your wife do those 2 weeks?
We set a goal to eat at a different nationality restaurant every night, because Bangkok is, you know, such an international city. It's got all kinds of restaurants, and I remember eating German food in Bangkok and French. I went to a French restaurant once, and of course Chinese and Thai, and we went to a Scandinavian smorgasbord one night, and we took a little tour up to the, you know, the famous bridge over the River Kwai, and saw that. I remember an old-timey steam engine locomotive there from I guess, you know, from those days back in World War II, and there was something to do with a cave that was a tourist attraction where somebody hid. I forget now what the history of the cave was. We got drenched in a rainstorm there. And we took the river tours, Klong tours there in Bangkok, up and down the canals and the Klongs, as they're called there. And a lot of X-rated things, of course.
Yeah, I want to ask you about those.
Okay.
Well, tell me, Mr. Eby, you hadn't seen your wife for quite a while now, and you have these 2 weeks. Obviously, you're both looking forward to this very, very much. What was her impression of you after you'd been in country for this amount of time and seen so much combat?
Well, I don't know. She didn't. And I hadn't seen the hardest combat yet. That was still pretty early.
Okay.
The monsoon hadn't dried up yet, the southwest monsoon. So Pleiku was clobbered, and the Ho Chi Minh Trail was still a muddy mess, and there wasn't much driving and not too much shooting and everything. But that was about the last week before it was going to get, or the last 2 weeks, before it was going to heat up quite a bit. And I had seen enough to know that what I was about to get into, I really wasn't going to like. And so I spent that 2 weeks, and I didn't tell her because I didn't want to worry her, you know, or anything, but I kind of savored every moment because I kind of figured that might be the last time I would be with her. And I remember when I took her to the airport for her to get back on her flight, it was that was probably the hardest moment of my life, seeing her walk up the stairs on that airplane, because I kind of figured I wouldn't see her again.
What was it like for her having to leave you?
Well, it was tough, but she didn't know the details of the monsoon seasons and all that sort of thing, and how hot it was about to get. You know, I didn't burden her with that, so it was hard for her in kind of a generic way, but for me it was much more specific, you know.
Sure.
What I do remember about her impressions when she arrived there, not so much about me, but that was in October, I think, and in Ohio, where we had put her down and the kids when I left, it was getting pretty chilly, you know, so she was wearing clothes that were kind of kind of warm clothes. Well, she got off there in Bangkok, and it was like a sauna. And we caught this taxi into town, you know, and we were zooming by little boys riding on water buffalo, you know, plowing the rice paddies and stuff. And it, she kind of thought she made the wrong turn or something and ended up on Mars, you know. It, she was just totally, just, I mean, it hit her. She hadn't expected that much difference, and it was totally a new world to her. It took her a little while to kind of get used to that.
Well, tell me, after your time there with Rustic Facts, do you go back to Play Coup again?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. And are you continuing these same kinds of interdiction missions, I assume, on the trail?
Except by that time the monsoon had broken up, and from that time on until I left following May, it was hot and heavy. Where up until that point it had just been intermittently, you know, semi-interesting, but mostly it was a matter of battling the weather during the monsoon.
Well, you say it became so much more hot and heavy here. If there's such thing as a typical mission that you're on, can you describe a typical mission once the monsoons have cleared and the traffic on the trail picks up?
Yeah. Of course, the typical was pretty atypical, you know, but you'd be scheduled for a mission either the early morning, I think it was, well, it was about dawn, just before dawn when you take off. I think it was like 6 to take off at 6 and land maybe, or planned to finish up about 10. And the next mission would leave maybe 10 to 2 and the last one 2 to 6 or sundown. And then the night guys would take over. And so a typical mission somewhat depended on which one of those you flew, you know. But in the early morning mission, you'd go out, and in the first place, you'd brief with the intel shop there and see what the night guys had found and where the activity was and who had been shooting, and whether there were any teams that were doing anything unusual or any of that sort of stuff, you know. But, and if everything was semi-normal then, why, you know, as you took off, why, then you'd go out and try to catch a few stragglers moving in the early morning hours, the ones that hadn't finished their drive during the dark. And you might see one or two, and you might not. And you check out the hot spots. There were different places. They had Delta numbers, Delta 47 and Delta this and that and the other thing. We also had nicknames for them all, which are the only ones I remember. I don't remember the Delta numbers anymore. But these were the points in the trail where they had to cross a river, like a ford, or perhaps go through an exposed part of a mountain pass, or the north, the Red Cliffs were, there were White Cliffs and Red Cliffs. I think the White Cliffs were up north, and the trail came down from the north on top of a plateau, and then it had to get down to the valley, and where it came off the plateau down the face of this slope, going down the valley, we called the White Cliffs, I think. And the road was exposed there. And so, you know, you check out all these high interest, and all these high interest points had a lot of guns around them, because that's where many of the strikes would go in, and where the FACs spent most of their time and stuff. So those are the ones they would defend the heaviest. So, you know, if you didn't have anything else going on, and as part of the briefing before you left, you would get any pre-fragged strikes that were pre-planned. And, you know, so if you had a pre-planned strike on one of the Delta points or something, well, then you'd kind of plan the rest of your mission around that, so you'd be close by when the fighters got there, and plus having checked it out ahead of time, you know, see if there's anything specific worthwhile shooting at. And so, anyway, if you didn't have any pre-planned strikes or any particular thing to do, you'd just cruise up and down the various trails. This is a whole spider network of trails, most of them hidden in the jungle. And so you'd cruise around, visual reconnaissance, you know, and just look for all these telltale things I was explaining before, to try to find where they were hiding. And so that would be a typical mission. And a lot of the typical pre-planned strikes went into these interdiction points or these delta points to try to crater the road, or in the case of the White Cliffs where they came down the side of a mountain, you try to slide the road out from the hillside out from underneath the road, you know, and destroy the road that way. But they had bulldozers at all those points, and as soon as the sun would go down, the bulldozers would come out and take them about an hour maybe till they rebuild the road, and then they'd drive the rest of the night, all night long across there. The night guys would try to get them, and they seldom could.
Yeah, that really brings up a pretty good point, something we haven't talked about yet, and that is your impression of the enemy that you were facing. What was your impression of the Vietnamese enemy?
The NVA I respected very highly because they were very good at what they did. They were courageous. I wouldn't have wanted to have been down there facing my strikes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what their casualty rate was, but it had to be really, really high, and yet we couldn't stop them, you know. They just kept going and kept going and kept shooting. And the gunners were extremely good at what they did. Of course, they've been doing it for years. And so I had a very healthy respect for them. I really did. And which I think we touched on this before. After all was said and done and I was back home, I discovered that I had a healthy respect for the NVA and a loathing and nothing but bad feeling for our allies, the South Vietnamese. That was interesting to me, the way that ended up, because it really did. I hated the South Vietnamese and I respected the North.
In your time as a rustic fact, excuse me, did you face any Khmer Rouge forces?
Yeah, I think that they were the primary forces that we were after, that were attacking the good guys. I'll tell you a story that I haven't told very many people about that, about out in Cambodia. You know, we did have ammo for our guns, and of course we had Marken rockets for Willie Pete's for strikes, but we were not. In order for us to expend our own ordnance, we had to have the same approval from the commander of 7th Air Force that we did for an airstrike.
Wow.
Under threat of Article 15 or a court martial, even higher than Article 15, if we expended our own ordnance. And of course, you can't hide it. When you get back, you've either got ammo or you don't, you know.
Now, is this including even the white phosphorus or the M60?
Everything.
Everything. Wow.
If you had not put in a strike, then you'd better have all your rockets left when you get back, or you'd get court-martialed. And so, and I, having come from Laos, or I just spread the cheer around just whenever I felt like it, you know, just to keep guys on their toes. I really chafed under that, but I really didn't want to get court-martialed either, although, I kept talking to myself and then answering myself. about what are they going to do, send me to Vietnam, you know, what are they going to do, kick me out? But I really didn't want to go through the mess of a court-martial and everything. And
sure.
So one day I was out over Cambodia, and I saw this column of people. It was like a lineup of people. It was, I think, two columns of two, maybe, and it must have been 50 to 100. I don't remember anymore, but it was a pretty good group of people. They were in civilian rags, but then nearly everybody in Cambodia was in civilian rags, even the Khmer Rouge. And, you know, nobody was in a nice, spiffy NVA green uniform. And the good guys were in civilian rags, too. That's what made it hard. You couldn't tell them apart. But here was this column of people walking out in the open across this field, like a pasture. And kind of like close order march. And there wasn't any village right there or anything, and I thought, this can't be local friendlies living there. They don't operate like that, you know. And so I rolled over and rolled in on them. I had my guns armed, you know, the arming switches on. I charged the guns, had the gun sight set for strafe. All I had to do was pull the trigger. And so I zoomed over their heads real, real low. Like I could have hit somebody in the head with my belly tank. Trying to deter, they were acting like they had farming tools and stuff, you know, hand tools that they were making little motions and stuff, like they were hoeing the ground or something with. So the grass wasn't disturbed or anything. They weren't farming. And so I was absolutely convinced that this was maybe a platoon of Khmer Rouge. And so I zoomed over them real low, and then I did a whiffer-deal and pulled up around and came back again from the other direction, just hoping that one of them, because I was convinced that these farming implements they were pretending to use were rifles, you know, and they kind of had them under their rags and clothes and stuff, but they were acting like they were farming with them. And I was trying to get them to somebody to break ranks and whip his rifle up and shoot at me, and then I was going to mow them down, you know. And nobody did, and I went over them again, even lower. I mean, if there would have been a tall one in the crowd, I'd have hit him in the head. And nobody broke ranks. And I did it a third time. And they just stayed right there, bent over, looking at the ground, you know, making these little motions. And nobody panicked. I think if any of them had even run, I'd have just squeezed the trigger. And so I thought, well, you disciplined mothers, you know, if you're that disciplined, I guess I'd better leave you alone. So I stayed low, and I flew over behind some trees and went out of sight, you know, and then I came right back around again to see, and they were gone. They were just clear gone. So I know they were Khmer Rouge, and I didn't shoot any of them. And that has bothered me as much over the years as anything else that I did, or in this case I didn't do, because, you know, as soon as we pulled out of Cambodia, the killing fields cranked up, and those guys, there's no telling how many hundreds of innocent people they killed, and I didn't shoot them when I had them dead in my sights. But I also couldn't have gotten permission to strike them. I knew from having tried before that people that were not shooting at you would not get approved for a strike. And if I had got approved, it had been 3 hours, and I wouldn't have been there anymore, and they'd have been gone too, so there wasn't any point in it, you know?
Right. And of course,
I let them live, and when I got, I was so disgusted, partly with myself, that when I got back, I didn't even debrief that in the intel. I just thought these, you know, our command and control and political situation is so screwed up, nobody wants to win anyway, why should I bother to tell them? So I didn't.
So this is a mindset or an attitude you began to develop throughout your tour there, is that correct?
Pretty much. In that case, that was strictly personal. But that helped to set the tone for the rest of the tour, sure enough. And, you know, we were hamstrung by our own people much more so than by the enemy. That's kind of hard on your attitude, all right?
Sure.
But the way it ended up, though, as I explained the first time, you always end up fighting for the guy, your own buddies next to you, anyway. And that's what I did. When I got to Killing Guns towards the end of my tour there, I mean, that was my most jaded time because I knew all was lost and that it was out of control and the politics were just self-destructive and there wasn't any point in it. But I figured if every gun that I killed would not be shooting at my buddies. And so, you know, I kept my nose to the grindstone and kept my derriere on the line there to help out my buddies. But I knew it was all futile. We weren't going to allow ourselves to win that war. The politicians weren't. And so it kind of works on your mind, but it didn't affect my actions that much. It affected my attitude, but as far as killing things and guns and doing my job, I kept on doing that partly from professional pride, I suppose, and partly from protecting my buddies.
Well, when you get orders to leave Vietnam, when your tour is over, what were your feelings on leaving?
Well, I couldn't wait to leave. I hated the place. I hated everything about it. And when I got on that freedom, here's a little story. the day came for me to leave, and it was an American Airlines 707. And I walked across that ramp. I thought I was feeling mighty good, you know. I had survived this mess, and I was going home and leave all this behind. And I walked up the rear stairs to the rear door of that 707, and I took one step inside, and I just froze. There was color in there. The interior of that airplane had colors. There were flight attendants there that were smiling, and they had colorful uniforms on. They were friendly, and I couldn't handle it. That caught me by surprise so much that I just froze in mid-stride, and I couldn't comprehend it. It had been life and death and army drab green, you know, and gunmetal gray, and nobody smiling, and terse and tense and sad and everything for so long that the realization, that moment of seeing color, just didn't compute, and I just froze right there. Finally, somebody gave me a shove, you know, and I kind of came to and went on. girls were all looking at me like I was crazy, and I pretty much was, I guess.
It's very, very interesting. It was the colors you mentioned a number of times there that really brought this back to you.
Yeah, like the real world, you know. Mm-hmm. There is a real world out there I'd almost forgotten, and I certainly wasn't prepared for it.
You say you weren't prepared for it. In what ways?
Well, I just had kind of lost track of what the real world was like outside of the war, and I thought I was, you know, happy and excited about going home, but I didn't have a clue. You know, I had gotten so jaded and I don't know what the other adjectives are for it, but when I saw that color brought home to me that, man, there is a world back there. I'm going home to it.
So when did you get back to the United States, back to your family?
And what about family?
I said, when did you get back to the United States? When did you get back to your family?
My DROS was May the 12th, 3 days early. Probably got home about the 15th or so.
Okay.
And there's a story there. For one thing, on the flight across the Pacific, I slept the whole way. Man, my body just let down, you know, and I couldn't even stay awake. I'm sure I must have eaten, but I don't remember. I do remember the airplane stopping in Hawaii for fuel, and we got off and I drank a Mai Tai there on a veranda somewhere, and then I slept all the way from Honolulu we went into Los Angeles. Or no, we went into Norton, down by Los Angeles. But I mean, on that flight going over, when I was going to new scary things, I didn't sleep at all. And I couldn't sleep, and you know, all keyed up and everything. Coming back, I couldn't do anything but sleep. And then we called a cab, a group of us, to LAX from Norton, and got on a TWA flight to connecting in Chicago, and then to Dayton. And we were a little bit late getting into O'Hare, and had a real close connection, you know, and I ran, because the flight to Dayton was the last flight of the day, I ran through O'Hare and got down to the gate. I don't remember what airline it was now, going to Dayton. It was a small, like a twin engine plane, and I ran down the jetway, and the agent was down there just closing the door. The airplane was still sitting there. Of course, this is in 71, you know, when all the anti-war stuff was going on. And I was in uniform, 1505s, and you know, a guy coming back from Vietnam just had that look. It just, everybody just had that returning veteran look. And so I ran down there and I yelled at the agent to, you know, keep the door open. He turned and looked up the jetway, took one look, knew I was coming back from Vietnam, and he closed the door and sent the airplane on.
Is that right?
Yep.
And what was your reaction to this?
I was standing there beside him with the airplane still there before it started pushing back, and he would not open the door. I probably now I would have knocked him off the jetway, you know, down on the ramp and ended up in jail, but then I was so beat down from the combination of all the anti-war stuff that had occurred between Norton and LAX and Chicago and everything, and then this he sneered at me as he closed the door and sent the airplane on, and I just I was so beat down, I didn't even do anything. I just walked back up, and then I had to stay the night. After being gone a year, stay the night in Chicago before I could get the next flight out in the morning. So that's one of my memories, not a good one.
That's incredible. What was your reception at LAX?
The only thing I remember is I didn't get spit on. I remember demonstrators and people yelling and, you know, the baby killer thing and all that stuff. And I remember that the smog was so bad on the freeway in that cab that I couldn't keep my eyes open. I was crying, tears running down my cheeks just from the smog. Except for just generic people making fools of themselves, you know, nobody hit me or spit on me or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were under strict orders to not retaliate. Don't you dare hit anybody or retaliate for any of this stuff. And it was just one more cog in the wheel that ground you into fine dust and discarded you, you know. And then the agent in Chicago was the last straw. I think I'd kill him now if somebody did that to me. I'd have knocked him off there, and then, you know, the jetway is up off the concrete quite a few feet. But I just turned around and walked back that time.
Looking back, I'm sure it was the right move to make. although it would have been a difficult one, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Now, you've come back from all of this, all you've seen, and you're experiencing firsthand this backlash against the American veteran returning from Vietnam. How did you find, or maybe I should say, in what shape did you find the United States a year after you left, when you came home? What did it seem like to you had changed?
Well, the U.S., I don't know. I think I described my family's welcome home, didn't I, the first time when nobody said anything?
No, you were going to.
Oh.
Then we decided to put it off till later. So why don't you explain that to me? That's
okay.
Very, very important.
So finally, a day later, or, you know, the next day, I get home to Dayton, and, you know, then there weren't any gates or fences to keep people off the ramp or anything. People could walk out to the airplane and greet people getting off and stuff. And the door was wide open to the gate, but the airplane didn't have a jetway. It just, we went down the ladder onto the ramp, and wasn't anybody there. So I walked across the ramp to the open door, and there was my family. And they were just standing there looking at me. And my wife grabbed me, you know, and we hugged and kissed. And like my little girls, the last time I'd seen them, they were 2 and 4. Now they were 3 and 5. And, you know, they were squealing and jumping up and down. But nobody else said anything. And my wife, the other day when we were talking on the phone, she pointed out to me that probably it was just one of those moments when nobody knew what to say, so they didn't say anything, you know. But it certainly was a long, pregnant pause before her mother, who always takes charge and makes everything all right, you know. She just kind of waved her hand and said, "Hi," and that's how I came home.
How did you interpret your family's silence at the time?
As disapproval and embarrassment and very uneasy. They had, you know, I was the only guy that had been in the military in my generation, and certainly the only one been in a war, and they just didn't know how to handle it because, of course, you know, they were all dedicated liberals and pacifists, and so they just didn't know how to handle their black sheep, you know.
Do you think that's what it was?
Not knowing how to handle it?
Mm-hmm.
You mean?
Yes.
Well, that's certainly part of it. And, of course, the other part was disapproval. You know, they continue to love me. I have no doubt about that, but it was a very awkward situation.
Now, has that view, has that relationship changed over time?
Oh, not really. We continued until my parents died to not agree on much of anything, really. Especially relating to politics and the war and peace and that sort of thing. They were good people. They were very good people. They'd do anything for anybody, really. Almost naive to that, to somewhat of an extreme. But there's just a lot of subtle things that go into it. You know, they literally were pawns of the socialist communist propaganda. They really believed all that. And I remember when I was young, before I even registered for the draft, I was talking with my mom, who was intelligent, more so than my dad. It was just a hard-working farmer, you know. But mom was pretty intelligent, but she still believed all this liberal line and communist propaganda. And she, you know how today there's still a lot of people who think it's America's fault. Anything that happens in the world is America's fault. You know, blame America first. Well, she was among the originators of that attitude. It was always our fault that anything bad happened in the world. And I remember one time saying, well, you are glad that we won World War II, are you not? And she said, that's not fair. That's not fair. And we had been arguing for quite a while, so it was time to let it rest, you know. But I went away thinking, now what is not fair about that? And I came to the conclusion over the years then that whenever you pin a liberal to the wall with rational thought, then it's not fair, and they just go away, you know. It's just not fair. So the conclusion to me is that liberals and pacifists don't rationally think things out. They just operate from feelings. And you can't argue with feelings. Feelings don't change as a result of an argument or a rational discussion, you know.
Sure.
So, you know, I gave up on them. I just quit talking about them. My sister, still the same way, exactly the same way. So we don't talk about anything meaningful. And my brothers aren't much better. So, there you have it.
When you got back, what did you choose to do for your career?
Well, I wanted to go with airlines, and I was over the beginning when I first got in the Air Force, and for the first year or so, and really on through, I really wanted to like the Air Force. If I could have had a real good excuse to stay in, make a career in the Air Force, I would have. I wanted to like it, but over the course of 5 years and all the experiences that I had, I just couldn't. I couldn't stay in, and so I had I had put in my separation papers well before I went to Vietnam, and I had a date established and everything. And so this was in February of 72, and that was recession time, and no airlines were hiring anywhere in the world. I applied everywhere from Qantas to, I mean, everybody in the U.S., and no airlines were hiring, and I was at Travis, stationed at Travis, after I came back from Vietnam until I finished up, and I couldn't even get a truck driving job out there in California, and I've been driving trucks since I was 9 years old, you know, and there wasn't a job anywhere like back in Ohio or anywhere else. There was no work. So I tried selling soap, direct sales, but I also could not stay in. I just was burned out, worn out, beat down, everything as far as the Air Force was concerned. And I felt like I would really have been compromising myself if I had stayed in just for the sake of a paycheck. And so I went ahead and got out, and I didn't have a prayer of a job, and had two girls to feed and everything. So worked as a laborer in a tomato cannery for a little while, and then I got a good job, doubled my pay to $4 an hour as a mechanic for the Navy down in Alameda in their P3 rework Iran facility. And then after 9 months, Delta called, and I got hired by Delta Airlines, and spent the next 31 years nearly with them. Retired 5 years ago.
Hmm. Mr. Eby, looking back on your experiences in Vietnam, a number of general interpretive questions I guess I have to ask you now. One is, and this is a huge question. Please feel free to answer it in any way that you see fit. Is what do you take from your experiences in Vietnam, personally?
Well, I don't know. That's a deep and abiding question. I haven't been bitter exactly. I've probably had moments of bitterness early on, but not generally, and it didn't last. And for however long, probably 20 years, I think we all tried to ignore it. And I know I did personally, and the whole country just tried to put Vietnam behind them, you know. And there was very little good literature written on Vietnam. There was some bad stuff, but nothing written that was worthwhile. And we didn't talk about it. We didn't have any FAC reunions or any FAC association or any of that stuff that we have now for 20 years. But but you can't ignore something like that. You know, you can try and you can act like you are, but it stays with you. Then after a while, and during that 20 years, even though I thought I had put it all behind me and everything, you know, I had lots of aggressive dreams and daydreams and stuff, very aggressive, you know, shooting and fighting and stuff like that. So I knew there was still some toxins, you know, floating around in my system, but I still tried to ignore it. And then it seemed like the whole country all of a sudden just kind of got over that that phenomenon, and some good books started to be published on Vietnam by veterans and first-person accounts and historical things and stuff, and all of a sudden somebody was trying to put together a FAC association, you know, and so I joined that and found out that somebody had put together a FAC net on the internet where FACs could communicate back and forth, you know, and so after all this period of silence, why, it started to come back, and that was very cathartic for me, especially the FACnet, where you could, I started to learn, for instance, through the FACnet that all these other guys were having similar reactions and experiences that I have been having all this time, and we'd all been trying to put it behind us, and none of us could, and So, then somebody started a project to write a FAC history book, and I thought, well, I'd like to be part of that, you know, so I volunteered to help with that, and I ended up being the editor of all the 20th TASS material that the guys wrote for the history book. And it got way too big for a book, and so
sure.
They went electronic and turned it into a CD, and it's a huge thing. You probably have, I don't know if you've seen it or not, but I'm sure you have a copy of it there in the archives.
I'm sure we do.
And so I devoted just about all of my spare time for 2 years to that, and edited all that stuff. A lot of it needed some heavy editing. And I wrote some stories of my own, and the CD turned out wonderful, but that experience, 2 years of reading and editing other people's experiences, and plus writing my own, was very cathartic, and I've had a less troubled life ever since. And to where I can, you know, I can just enjoy the friendship of these guys now instead of a kind of a clinging sort of bond. But I've learned a lot. One thing, plus during all this time, even during the silent period, I started reading every book I could find written by combat veterans of any war, writing first-person accounts. And I came across this series, Time Life series, called Wings of War. And I thought, well, that first one sounded really interesting, so I'll order that and then I'll cancel, you know. Well, I ended up with the whole collection, and every book was just wonderful. And I've read just everything else I could find. First-person accounts is what I was really looking for. And interested in, and I've discovered from all that no matter what war it is and what you were doing, whether you were ground pounding or flying or on a submarine or whatever, the bonds you forge as warriors are stronger than any other bonds you form, even stronger than some of your family. Maybe not your spouse necessarily, but and so thinking on that, then I realized that as much as you hate it when it's going on, and I hated Vietnam, I hated the whole fuel experience. I didn't hate the combat as much as I did all the other aspects of it. And actually, the combat was kind of a release a little bit from the. Especially in Laos, where nobody's watching, from all the other frustrations. But the experience of going toe to toe with another human being, and one of you is going to end up dead, is an experience that changes a man, a person, like nothing else can and does. And it's kind of the ultimate human experience a little bit, because you, when either you're going to die or he's going to die, it doesn't get much deeper than that, you know, and you learn a lot about yourself, and about courage and lots of things, you know, character and stuff that you don't learn any other way, and that's why nobody understands that except another combat veteran, and that's why the bonds are so strong between veterans, is that they're the ones that have gone through that, and they're the only ones that can understand it. You know, you can explain and talk and everything to somebody that's never been to war, and they can nod and agree and try to relate, but they can't unless they do it and it's in their gut, you know. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but
absolutely.
That's what came to mind.
No, that's absolutely spot on. Well, tell me about what you think about American policy that led to the United States becoming involved in Vietnam, as well as the way the war was prosecuted. Again, a very wide open question to answer however you see
it. Well, it was just a long string of tragedy and error as far as policy goes in my mind, and nobody understands Vietnam unless you put it in the greater context of the Cold War. You know, it was a hot part of a Cold War, a bigger Cold War, and it was the West, it was freedom versus communism, really, which is the reason I was willing to take part in it, because to me it was a cut and dried question, and it was liberty versus tyranny, and specifically democracy versus communism. And so I didn't have any trouble with that decision. But could we have avoided Vietnam? I'm sure we could have. I'm sure there's a string of mistakes that led to it in the first place. You know, war is just a continuation of international relations, and it's always a mistake. War, when nations end up in war, it means somebody made a mistake, if not everybody. And but the fact was that the communist world was intent on dominating the whole world, and whether that was the place to pick the fight or not, I don't know. I believed then, and I still believe, the domino theory was valid in Southeast Asia, and at least at that time. And even though we lost the Vietnam War, it was part of the scenario that led to winning the Cold War. So really, Vietnam was a battle that we did not prevail in, but we prevailed in the war. So, I don't know. I don't know if there will ever be a real, true answer to whether it was the right thing to do and the right time to do it or whatever. And certainly the way we prosecuted it was stupid. I think we've pretty well covered that from...
Sure.
From the military command and control system all the way up to the Congress and the White House, it was mismanaged, mishandled, and was utterly stupid. And I think that's what beat me down, that in this comedy of errors controlled by clowns. I was just part of the meat grinder, you know, a little morsel of meat in the big grinder, and I was expendable. And what I was expendable for was for some stupid politician to be proven right in a stupid policy, you know. So that is no wonder I was kind of beat down, but maybe I thought too much. I don't know. Been better off if I hadn't paid any attention to anything but my job, I suppose.
Well, Mr. Eby, is there anything else you'd like to add to the record before we wrap up the interview?
I don't think so.
All right, well, this will end the interview with Mr. Timothy Eby.